Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to call today's meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from March 3rd.
Thank you, Representative. You do that very well.
Thank you.
All those in favor of Representative Johnson's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendments are approved. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, my name is Wes Koister. I'm the Regional Administrator for the Metropolitan Council.
Great.
Mr. Chair, we have a lot of slides to go through. We're responding to some of the questions that were submitted to us earlier, and we've spent the last few days trying to put them in slide form. If we miss something, we'd be happy to get back to you right away. If we're not answering a question to your satisfaction, let us know that. We'll try to do that, and if we need to get information, we'll get back to you in that with that in that regard as well as promptly as we can. We'll do our best to answer the questions that you have. I have some support in the audience, so if I can't answer a question, others may be able to that are here.
Excellent.
I'm going to start with a bit of a transportation, just a quick transportation overview. I'll mention that this slide is in a calendar year because our budget is on a calendar year basis. This gives you sort of an orientation to what our budget sources are. You'll see here that for transit services in the metropolitan region covering the seven county area, our largest resource is Minnesota vehicle sales tax receipts. An amount of about $268 million for fiscal year 2000, for calendar year rather 2017. It shows state appropriations of about $95 million. Again, this crosses two fiscal years, so if you're wondering why it doesn't match up with your fiscal year appropriation, it's because this is calendar year, so it crosses two fiscal years. The use of reserves I'll get into later, which is a planned use of reserves. The fares are about 20%. Local funds are primarily directed towards light rail through the County Transit Improvement Board, CTIBS, funding of 50% of the light rail costs. And then we have some federal dollars that we use as a result of congestion mitigation and air quality grants from the feds for short-term grants for services. And also some of the federal capital money shows up in our operating budget because we have people who work in operations that sometimes are assigned to capital projects like shelters and so forth that are so tightly tied to operations that we charge some of their costs to capital, and that shows up as federal dollars in our sources. On the next page,
that shows, Mr. Quistra, in relation to that CMAQ funding, the capital for the congestion mitigation air quality money, apparently there was a change in the way the feds administer or require that to be spent, maybe not this year, but in years past. Is that? I had some folks in my office today that were talking about that issue and that they were required to spend the money in a certain fashion.
Mr. Chair, I'm getting inquisitive looks back when I look at the people in the audience. So let me ask that question when I get back and get back to you. I'm not acquainted with the change.
I struck that
on your first question.
Yeah, I just wanted to verify that had happened and when, and we'll do that at a later time. Thank you.
Okay. The operations budget uses is the next slide, and that shows that Metro Transit bus is the largest category at 58%. If you add bus together, and that would include Metro Transit bus, the suburban transit providers, which is listed as STPs here, and contracted services, you're seeing that the budget uses at about 70% of the total budget goes towards bus. So this really shows that transit in the Twin Cities area in the metropolitan region is about bus. There's multimodal, but bus is the foundation of the transit system. Bus is about 70% of the budget. It's about 75% of the fare revenues that you'll see later. Light rail is about 13% of the budget and 23% of the fare revenues. Metro mobility is a story that we're telling in our budget because of the increased demographics and the increased costs related to mandated ridership. So it's at 71 million and but growing, and then you'll see other things like commuter rail and a very small amount attributed to planning on that page.
Ms. Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. I understand, well, looking at light rail, the contribution or the grants from CTIB that supports operating costs of light rail, how much is that and where does that show up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, let me go to the next page that shows that.
Okay.
This page shows the operations budget by source and specifically by funding service category. Let me to Representative Runbeck's question. You'll see that the local light rail revenue is $24.5 million. That represents 50% of the light rail operations costs that are subsidized. After fares, after other sources. So the subsidy portion is shared 50% between the state and 50% with CTIB, and that's $24.5 million. While I'm on that subject, you'll see the general fund is at for the light rail is at $14.6 million. But the use of reserves on the reserve column is $10 million. That primarily makes up the difference, because those reserves are primarily state sources, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. As an overview of this page, getting back to an overview of this page, Metro Transit and all the other services, general fund and the motor vehicle sales tax are by and large flexible and can be used across many of the services. But because the state requires state statute requires the state to fund light rail transit at 50% of its subsidized portion of its operating costs, we attribute the first general fund dollar to light rail transit operations. So you'll see there that's $14.6 million on this page. And then because state and federal law requires Metro Mobility Services, there's a mandate from the federal government on Metro Mobility Service, and there's additional service geography that's required by state statute, we fund that next out of the general fund. And you'll see there that Metro Mobility takes up the largest proportion of general fund money at $62.1 million. Then what's left over, we provide those funds to bus. And in this case, we show it all going to Met Transit, but when we do our allocation model with suburban transit providers, we put the general fund together with the MBEST funds, and we distribute it across all services. We just happen, for simplicity, to allocate the general fund dollars to Met Transit first, but they're all in one pool and considered together when we see what's available for the region as a whole and to try to distribute it as equitably as possible. We have a model to do that.
Thank you. So getting back to Representative Runbeck's question about state funding for the light rail, so the reason that reserve number shows up is because of this calendar year versus fiscal year, or is there another reason?
I wish I had simple explanations. I'm going to do my best. We budget MBEST and other funds at 95% of what's available to us, and then we assume that 5% of those costs will be paid for in the will be used 5% of those revenues will be used in the following year. The reason we do that is because MBEST has been so volatile, we did not want to budget the entire 100%. The 100% is budgeted over 2 years, so that becomes a planned use of reserves. The next year we put the money we didn't budget into the reserves, and the next year we use it as part of the base appropriation. And so that gives us time when the revenue sources do not perform. It gives us a year to adjust, because we're always budgeting 95% of what's available in that year. And that's served us well, because one thing that's really important to transit service is that it's reliable. So we can't be going up and down with service as the revenues fluctuate. And MBEST has proven to be volatile. MBEST has proven to be a difficult revenue source for us in lean years, because people don't buy cars in lean years. So in the worst of times, it goes down. in the best of times, it tends to go up.
Certainly. I appreciate that and understand it. But light rail is not subject to MVIST funding,
right,
if I'm reading your chart correctly. And this is a minor point.
Let me get back to you with the specifics of the
just curiosity.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I would also point out on there that shows the fares, it shows the federal revenues. You'll see on the Metro Transit bus section, the federal revenues, and those were the CMAQ grant along with some capital expenditures that used operating staff that we got reimbursed for through the capital budget.
Representative Petersburg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, either one. Just a question in regards to the STPs. Are they running through the Met Council as part of the Met Council's budget, or are they independent, or how does that work? Because I thought they were kind of controlled by other local road authorities or transit authorities. So I'm just curious as to clarification on that piece.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson.
Go ahead.
Petersburg, rather. The suburban transit providers have their own commissions or boards that govern their activities. We share revenues. We share in the state general fund and MVEST revenues. And so in that sharing, we have a model for allocation of those revenues to ensure that everybody's on equal playing field. It's based upon an assumption of certain range of reserves that people that transit providers need to have, and it's assumption on money that's available, and then we have a very sort of precise allocation model that ensures that all the funds are distributed equitably across the providers. So they participate in the allocation. We allocate state resources across the region, but we do not govern those services.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. So just for clarification, that basically you're just a flow through of the funds because it all comes into Met Council and then you distribute to those particular ones, if that's correct.
Well, from a governance perspective, from an allocation of funds perspective, it is our responsibility to allocate those funds. It's a little more complicated than a pass-through, but it does go through a model. And then we have to ensure certain federal compliance on some issues, especially when there's the use of federal monies.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, we're going to be there's a bill up tomorrow that talks about this a little bit. And just to give you a little further background, it's prior to 2001, the suburban transit providers collected a sales tax, or excuse me, a property tax in the areas that they operated. In the 2001 tax bill, converted that over to the motor vehicle sales tax. And at that point, we were getting, I believe, 21.5% of motor vehicle sales tax. So the suburban providers got a percentage of the motor vehicle sales tax that would have made that the equivalent of what they were bringing in related to property tax. And then, as folks know, in 2008, or 2007, the constitutional amendment passed, and there was the phase-in of motor vehicle sales tax from the 21.5% to 36%. And over that time is what Mr. Cuesta is explaining, is that there is a pot of dollars there that then is shared regionally amongst all of the providers. So when you say the money flows through, that is how that works. And it's based on that gap is based on demand.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the next page is getting into the fare box questions that you had. This shows the fare box recovery, subsidy per passenger, and annual ridership by service type. This is calendar 2014 year data because that's the last audited data that we have. We're in the current process of auditing, of reviewing and looking at 2015 data. This is, again, calendar year 2015 data, 14 data. And, of course, 2016 data is still coming in. But this is 2014, but we don't think that there's been significant changes across these larger categories. One thing I would point out, the fair recovery is, you'll see here, the fair recovery is not a direct indicator of subsidy per passenger because the subsidy per passenger is driven both by fare recovery rates and the total operating costs. So you could have a very high fare recovery rate for a service, but a very high operating cost, and it still leaves a more significant subsidy per passenger. Shown up here on Express Bus, it's 37% fare recovery. It's the highest rate of fare recovery we have across our services. And again, this is data across the region, includes suburban transit providers. And the subsidy per passenger is $3.86 per ride. Light rail has just a slightly smaller fare box recovery, but the subsidy is much less because the cost, the overhead cost for those services are less for light rail than they are for Express Bus.
Mr. Kuistra, do you ever analyze these numbers in a subsidy per mile? In other words, a higher subsidy on a longer trip is maybe a worthwhile investment, yeah. Whereas a higher subsidy on a short trip is more alarming.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that data is available to us, and if you would like us to take a look at that and get that to you, we can get that to you. It gets into issues like fares, whether there's been discussion of distance-based fares, those sorts of issues as well. So it kind of ties into that question.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kuistra. If I read this correctly, the subsidy per passenger mile, if it was fare box recovery was 33%, the subsidy per passenger would be double of what the fare box actually is per passenger. So is that how I would read this, that the cost that the average passenger is for the Express bus would be basically $1.90 on Express and about 90 cents on light rail on the average?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand the question, but let me try to answer it this way and see if it works. If the fare box recovery is 37%, the 386 would represent, I assume, would represent 63% of the total cost.
Right.
Does that answer your question,
Mr. Chair? And Mr.
Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what I'm getting to is we talk about the subsidy per passenger as far as what the state and other taxpayers put into that, but we oftentimes forget about what the actual rider pays as well. So I'm just trying to get at a kind of a handle on what the cost is per rider and versus what is paid for by others that aren't particularly riding at that. And I'm just assuming you can take that percentage and divide and make it the case, but I was just want right. to make sure I was reading it properly.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair,
Mr. Kuistra,
Representative, we can get you all the fare information too, which is really really at the crux of your question: what right. fares are riders you. Paying? We can get that to you,
Mr. Chair, and Representative Petersburg as well. In Representative Runbeck's committee a few weeks ago, Representative Calabar asked for some information related to subsidies per passenger, passengers per hour, all of that. So what we were able to provide was information that I think Mr. Marble included in your packets that provides additional detail that is basically laid out the same way that the Office of the Legislative Auditor looked at that back in the 2010 governance study. So there is some additional information there for you. And as Mr. Kloister said, we'll be happy to follow up on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the next slide breaks down the fare box recovery by service type and by service provider. The first one is Express Bus, which is, has been pointed out, is the longest ride. You'll see that Maple Grove has the highest fare box recovery for express service. That means that Maple Grove has pretty full buses. Maple Grove is situated where there's a lot of transit. Use for commute to downtown, and also they draw riders from the I-94 corridor going out of the cities. But at any rate, this shows you what the express bus route fares and recovery and subsidy per passenger are by provider. The largest provider is Metro Transit, and it's the second highest fare box recovery of 40%, and it serves about 7 million, almost 8 million riders at that amount.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we're looking at the subsidy, are we factoring in only, like, say, the cost of fuel and employees, or is this also factoring into, say, the cost of the bus or the train or any of that type or ongoing expenses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rarick, the cost is all the operating costs. It does not include the capital cost. I should want to also mention on this page that because this is 2014 data, it shows Prior Lake and Shakopee as separate from Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, MBTA, and since that time, Prior Lake and Shakopee has joined MBTA, so future reports would show that as all under MBTA, just as a technical point. The next fare box recovery is local bus. This should read suburban local bus. This is suburban to suburban service, and it's the same layout for the fare box recovery subsidy per passenger and passenger in the thousands. I might point out that you're going to see more volatile subsidies per passenger and fare box recoveries in this area because there's in some areas it's very little suburban to local service. It might be a very specialized service that they have an agreement with someone to provide. There's stories behind, especially the ones like Shakopee and Southwest Transit and Maple Grove, about how they provide service, where they provide services, and why they provide that service. So I don't want to misrepresent that in just a simple way with the chart. But this gives you an idea of what suburban to suburban bus costs across the region. The next slide provides a breakdown of the remaining services. First, we have the urban local bus. These are services that go into the urban cores of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Certainly, it's our largest ridership of over 56 million in Metro Transit, and you'll see that fare box recovery of about 22% on those services and the subsequent passengers shown there. And then you have light rail below and commuter rail. And then the demand services are Metro Mobility and Transit Link, and those are high, and they're always going to be higher than the others because they are demand services. They are based upon phone calls to schedule services. The buses are smaller. There's less riders per trip, and it's an expensive service. In the case of Metro Mobility, it's a mandated service. Transit Link provides services in communities where there's not a regular route bus, and it's a limited service that someone, for example, in Savage, where I live, can call and arrange a service if it's available. But often there's a capped amount available, so often it's difficult to schedule services in advance. But it's available. It's a critical service for those people who are able to use it.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Previously, kind of to follow up on Representative Rarick, and the capital cost is not included in the spare box recovery. We see a couple different modes from buses to light rail and commuter rail. If you added the capital cost, both whether it's paid by the federal, the state, or the local, how would that affect the fare box recoveries in the different modes?
Mr. Questra.
Well, Mr. Chair, it would lower it in all the modes, that's for sure. I think it gets more complicated with rail than it does with bus, because in the case of rail, if you're looking at the capital cost of the light rail development, it's certainly very expensive. Half of it's paid for by the federal government. The other primary portion of it is paid for by the County Transit Improvement Board through their sales tax. And then there's returns on those investments to the state in other ways of workers and payroll and economic investment. It's kind of hard to parse out the true subsidy per passenger on the capital development side, because there's lots of benefits to the state that don't show up in the absolute gross cost. Right?
A follow-up, Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to make a complicated question. Simply, the capital cost to build these different modes of transportation, if you factor in the capital cost with the operating, the differences in the fare box recoveries in the different modes, I think would, you mentioned that the light rail is significantly more capital intensive, and so am I to presume that the fare box recovery, if included with the capital and operating cost, would be inverse of what you show on your slide here?
Mr. Koester.
Mr. Chair, I would like to have an opportunity to look at it, because the lifespan is also different across those sorts of things. The buses we replace every 12 years. I believe Metro Mobility we replace every 5 years. The infrastructure for light rail is much, much longer term infrastructure, so you'd have to you'd have to amortize it over a number of years. I'm sorry. I wish it were a simple answer. I don't think it is. I think it requires more analysis than I can do on the back of an envelope.
Mr. Chair, so I guess more of a point then is that I'm kind of surprised that, you know, we're investing hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, and we don't really know that. And I think that's a good, you know, if we're comparing different modes and the best modes of transportation to get our workers and families around town, I think that's an important overall thing that we need to be looking at. And I'm just shocked that the Met Council hasn't provided that.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Shetman.
Chair and Representative Koznick, it is also important when we talked about the operating piece as well, is that when you take a light rail train, oftentimes there are three cars that are combined together that we're able to carry. When they're completely full, up to 600 people on those trains with one operator. And when you look at a regular bus, it could hold 40 people. So operational-wise, it is much more efficient that way, so that's why you're able to see the operating costs. But as Mr. Koestra mentioned, a light rail vehicle has an age of about, you know, 30-plus years that we're able to use that vehicle, and over that period of time, we are overhauling that bus. We are replacing those buses every 12 years based on a federal guideline. So it is a complicated question to answer, and we're happy to provide it. But I just want to make sure that the committee understands that these are definitely not apples-to-apples comparisons, and the way that we fund the capital for our bus system is different than how we fund the capital for our light rail system. And again, less than 10% of the capital funds for these light rail lines have been coming from the state.
Well, thank you, Mr. Shetman. I think really what we're trying to get after here is an understanding of the true costs of providing these services, and certainly capital costs are part of that. And we're just, I think, asking that we kind of have a, not a detailed analysis of that, but a picture that includes that as we take a look at these various modes of transportation. We're going to have to move along a little more quickly, ladies and gentlemen, or we're going to run out of time.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the next chart is answering the question about the use of general fund appropriations. As I mentioned, the use of general fund appropriations is flexible, and we use it first. The first dollar goes to light rail. I'm going to talk a little faster. The second dollar goes to Metro Mobility. In the past, the remaining funds have gone to bus for regional bus service. You'll see on this chart that due to the growth of Metro Mobility primarily, but also light rail services, absent a change in the appropriation, it will in 2019 the entire general fund will be used up by Metro Mobility and light rail. In fact, it won't be sufficient to fund the entire amount of Metro Mobility without an increase in that base. But the point here is that as the general fund base gets used increasingly for Metro Mobility and light rail, it pushes more of the bus costs into the MVEST category, and that's how we manage it over time. So there's a hierarchy of funding that we use. It wouldn't have to be done that way. That's what we've done to try to honor how state law is constructed in our interpretation of state law, with light rail first, Metro Mobility second, being mandated services, and then bus gets third dibs on it. And in 2019, there doesn't appear to be any funding left at that point. There was a question regarding the growth of MVEST and why. This is the page that shows the growth of MVEST and all the other appropriations against the services and how those services are funded. So what I'm showing here is the operating sources and the growth over an eight-year period that you requested, and the services costs over that same eight-year period. And this is an attempt to explain why, while we're having MVEST growing, why do we face a deficit? Well, the reason we face a deficit is because overall, all our revenues are growing at an overall rate of about 3.2% per year over that period of time, while our costs for services are growing at 4.8%. I would like to add a couple of nuances to that, or a couple of footnotes to that. If you look at light rail, which is one of the higher growth areas, the reason it's one of the higher growth areas is that includes service expansion for the opening of the Green Line between 2014 and 2015. Central Corridor benefits from a CMAQ grant, and that grant phases out over time, so we're losing federal monies, and that means that we need other resources to fill that gap. And then also in 2021 is the startup of the Southwest Light Rail service assumed in this. So that plays into the 6.5% growth. So that's not just inflation. In Metro Transit bus, that is primarily inflation. And then the others are primarily inflation except for Metro Mobility. And Metro Mobility you'll see over that eight-year period, an 8% growth is expected as a result of inflation and demographic growth. I think demographic growth that we're seeing right now is about 6.5%. Actual Metro Mobility growth is expected to be faster in the out years than what we're seeing in this 8% average over time. The next page shows the MVEST forecast. We came to you before and have spoken about how the forecast has been reduced over the four-year period, first in the February forecast, then in the November forecast. Well, in February, in this most recent February forecast, it rebounded slightly. So we were looking at a reduction in forecast since November 15 of $43 million. Now we're down to $34 million. So there is a bit of good news in the most recent forecast for transit. That changes our expected transportation transit deficit. It was originally $89 million, and with the addition of $9 million to MVEST that we were not expecting before, and then. We reconciled our 2016 books, and that brought another $6 million in savings. So now our total budget deficit has moved from $89 million to $74 million based upon those two factors. We're responding to questions about regional transit bonding and uses. We request authority well in advance of use for regional transit bonding. Capital projects start in a planning stage. Capital projects become actually authorized projects only after we have all the funds secured. So we have to wait until we have state funds secured, and we have to wait until we have federal funds secured, and then we move that project from planned to authorized. Many projects require a significant lead time. For example, bus purchases. We have to have the funds secured 15 months or more in advance of the bus purchase, because we can't enter into the contract for those buses until we have the funding secured. So we are purchasing buses, and we are receiving regional transit capital bonding authority for purchases that may be 2 years out in front of us, but we have to do that to get the capital purchase and project rolling. Regional bond, transit bond is used to leverage federal funds. We get up to 80% federal funding for our rolling stock, 80% match. There is a cap to our federal funding. We earn a capped amount of federal funding, and we have 80% match until we run out of funds. We typically match our buses with 80% federal funds. So happens at Metro Mobility, it's more like 40% federal funds, but that's just how we've chosen to apply the available federal dollars. The eligible projects include fleet, support facilities like garages, bus garages, and other bus related buildings. We have a significant park and rides, shelters, and other sorts of bus and support facilities and customer facilities. And then we also use those funds for current transitway capital, so for light rail or others that are already in place today, not for the development of new transitways. It's for maintaining current transitways. This shows the 2013-2016 authorized RTC projects. It breaks it down by fleet replacement, customer facilities like park and rides and shelters, support facilities like bus garages and other buildings that we manage out of. And then other capital includes equipment for automated passenger counts that we're adding to bus and rail, fare collection equipment, rail maintenance, capital maintenance equipment like repairing doors and windows and HVAC systems of existing rail cars. Again, it's not used for developing rail capital. I want to be clear about that.
Thank you. Representative Rundbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kustra, maybe a page back when you're talking about you may have a projected deficit. So, and that is apparently going to affect the bus system. So, do you constantly look at how to gain, more ridership and reduce perhaps the routes that are not producing or not maybe used as effectively? Or, what's the month-to-month sort of strategy, I guess, when looking at your bus budget?
Mr. Koistra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rundbeck, I'm glad you asked that question. We do that on a regular basis. We look at how routes are performing, and in years where our budget's heavy, we also look at routes that have a greater demand than we're able to meet. And a lot of times what we do is we move away from poor performing routes and move our resources into routes that are showing a greater demand. In bad times, we are not able to do the reinvestment. We call it harvest and reinvest, but in bad times, we're not able to do the reinvestment. Like right now, we're going through that same process of looking at non-performing routes and reducing service or eliminating service in non-performing routes, but we're not reapplying those investments elsewhere because where there is demand that would suggest we should, because we don't have the funds to do that. But we do that constantly. And then we are also always looking at ways to improve service, to improve ridership, but it's all part of a very... I think a fairly sophisticated analytical process that the Metro Transit staff and I'm sure regional the suburban transit providers do as well.
Thank you.
And then this is the next slide shows the planned RTC projects by the same breakdown as we had before. And then, Mr. Chair, I wanted to respond to questions on the Viking Stadium pedestrian bridge. The total project cost for that bridge was $11.7 million. $6.1 million was funded by the Vikings, $5.6 million by our regional transit improvement bond. This project was planned and included in our Metro Transit Capital Improvement Plan over time. We had money set aside for Downtown East, knowing that the stadium would probably require some capital investments in that area. There was a question about how we funded the $1 million of costs that were over budget. Well, the budget included a contingency that covered the $1 million of cost. That's a matter of practice across all these large construction projects. So after considering the contingency, the $1 million change orders were able to be absorbed within that contingency amount. So we were not over budget. We were over the initial cost estimate. But that's why we have contingency funds available for large construction projects. You asked about changes charges by state agencies. This shows that information. For the sake of time, I won't go through each one of these. But this, you see the state auditor's cost. We're audited by the state auditor each year. We have a allocation to the governor's office to pay for governor's office costs. The reasons are listed there. Recently, we had a water summit cost, and then you see the others listed. We receive some technology services from Minute that we pay for, and then the others are listed in front of you for the chargebacks that our agency receives. This is a list of the contractors for Central Corridor and then later that we'll have for Southwest. I don't know what more to say about this other than this is for the design and engineering phase of the project, and it's the typical consultant requirements that we have for any major capital project like Central Corridor represents and Southwest LRT represents.
And, Mr. Chair, in the response that we provided to you, we included more detail related to this. It just was going to be very busy if we tried to do this as part of this presentation.
And then this is the Southwest project list that I think you also have more detail on.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I would get started on the governor's budget. So I'm transitioning answering the questions to getting to the governor's budget proposal presentation. The governor is proposing a half-cent transit dedicated sales tax for the seven-county metro area. That's expected to yield about $174 million in 2018 and $271 million in 2019. Over 10 years, it's expected to bring in $3 billion to invest in transit. This will pay for the entire current state share and contributions to transit capital and operating costs for bus and light rail. It provides a stable and reliable funding source to support long-term transit planning for long-term service needs, which is how transit is planned. We have to plan for the long-term. Projects take a long time to get off the ground and to get completed, and we need a stable funding source for that purpose. The transit planning horizon is about 20 years by state law. State law requires to have at least a 20-year transit plan, policy plan, and some projects take many years to develop. It is difficult to execute long-term development without a reliable funding source. This particular proposal will, over the next 10 years, will accommodate 30% bus service growth, 14 BRTs, 11 of which are arterial BRTs, 2 light rail lines, and significant modernization of shelters and park and rides. It will also address bus facility needs. It's hard to get funding for bus garages. It's not very attractive to funders to fund a garage, but they're needed to make the service work. It also will improve services across the entire region. The suburban transit providers would benefit from this equally. The governor's proposal also relieves pressure on the state budget. As mentioned, the general fund operating costs will be relieved for all current and future transitways. For current transitways alone, which includes the blue line, green line, and red line, that amounts to $270 million of savings over the next 10 years. This is just representing the current lines that you are paying for. It also relieves the state of geo bonding pressure for future transit capital investments. And while Metro Mobility continues to be funded under this proposal by the general fund, the freed up general funds by removing the light rail and the bus funding from the state obligation, it frees up money to fully fund Metro Mobility, and on top of that, it saves the state $36 million and more in the first biennium. So why is transit important, and why are transit investments important? Because transit connects us to places that matter. It's a critical component of our transit system. Ultimately, transit matters because it connects people to places that matter most. Regional transit provides 324,000 rides daily, more than 98 million rides in 2015, and 80% of the riders are going to work and to school. So 80% of the transit riders are doing it for a purposeful ride to work and school. 40% of the people who work in downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul use transit. Transit's also a key component of the transportation system. It's part of transportation. Transit and roads are not separate systems. Transit contributes significantly to larger transportation goals of mobilizing people, goods, and services, and supporting economic development. It maximizes road infrastructure. It makes roads more efficient. One bus during rush hour is equivalent to 40 cars. One light rail train car during rush hour is equivalent to 200 cars. A three-car train is equivalent to 600 cars. At 35W rush hour, buses move the equivalent of 1.5 lanes worth of traffic. So it makes our transportation system more efficient. It makes better use of our roads. Our roads and transit are partners, not competitors. The transit investments are not just about light rail. We seem to talk about 95% of our time is about talking about light rail, when actually it's 23% of our ridership and 13% of our costs. Bus service represents 75% of the regional rides and 75% of the regional costs. And this is just as much about supporting the foundation of our transit system in bus as it is supporting some of these other services. But these other services are important when they're well placed. For example, the Green Line between Minneapolis and St. Paul has resulted in an 82% increase in ridership across all modes of transit in that corridor. So between now and before Green Line existed, there are 82% more riders of transit along the Green Line corridor. The A Line has increased ridership by bus arterial rapid transit that goes from Roseville to Minneapolis along Snelling, and that's increased ridership along that corridor by 33% since it just opened. So transit makes transportation better, and transportation investment in roads and bridges makes transit better. We're working together with MnDOT on the Orange Line as they're making changes to 35W, and we're able to efficiently make infrastructure changes together that benefit both what they're trying to accomplish on 35W and the service that we're trying to provide to make that investment the most efficient investment possible.
Mr. Koistra, you're doing a great job.
You want me to hurry.
But I'm afraid we've tried to cram more into this than we have time to. If you don't mind, I'd like to have you, and I'd love to hear all your accolades about transit, and I know they're valid, and I'm not trying to diminish their validity. But if you could skip ahead a few slides to the next 10 years, I think that's what we are most interested in. Much of this other information we have seen in other forums already, and we do have another presentation we're going to try to get to yet today. So you've done a wonderful job with all those slides, and I hate to jump over them, but this is where I want to be.
Mr. Chair, I'll do that. You're missing all my punchlines.
Are they funny?
And all the arguments.
Are they funny? No humor? Okay, then sorry.
The next 10 years, to your point, we will see, as I mentioned, $3 billion investment. It will expand the regional bus system by 30%. There will be more routes. There will be more frequent service on existing routes. This shows you where those improvements will be made. We are going to modernize the new system with technologies and real-time information updates. We're going to add 1,000 more shelters and with light and with heat. With respect to other aspects over the next 10 years, as mentioned, we're going to be building 11 arterial BRT lines that we've selected strategically that we think will hit those areas where there's that kind of demand for a faster bus service and a more efficient bus service, and we would expect to see similar results as we're seeing at the A line on Snelling. The orange line, BRT, would be paid for with that investment. The gold line, orange line, is 35W south, going south through to Burnsville and eventually to Lakeville. Gold line comes from Washington County through down the I-94 corridor to St. Paul. And then the red line extension that currently goes up Cedar to be extended onward. And then two strategically selected LRT lines in Southwest and Botano. This shows you, this is the graphic of the arterial BRTs that I mentioned to you. I'm rushing through this for the sake of your time, Mr. Chair, so forgive me. The A-line is shown there, and then the next page shows the build-out of the transit ways, and you'll see Gold Line on the far right of that screen. You'll see Botano in the lighter blue color going up to the left, upper left of the screen, and then Orange Line. They're all obvious because they're color-coded, so I don't need to point each of those out to you. That was my accelerated presentation, Mr. Chair.
I apologize for rushing you, but thank you. So I want to leave some time for questions. I have a number of questions, and we'll try to get through them quickly, members. First, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, there are a couple of statements in regards to the $3 billion anticipated revenue from the half-cent sales tax that you did, that you talked about. One, and so I just want to make sure that I'm clear that that's what you said. One says, provide stable and reliable funding source to support long-term planning, and that's on 25. And then 26, it says, relieve state GO bonding share of future transit capital investment. My question relates to that long-term planning, stable and reliable funding. Does that include the replacement, remodeling, the major renovations that are going to occur in 10, 20, and 30-year aspects of that?
Mr.
Chair, yes, it does. It really is intended to remove funding obligations of the state for bus and rail transitway projects and ongoing transitway capital maintenance costs of those projects. So we think it would create a significant savings to what the state would otherwise be faced with paying for. I can't predict that they would, but they'd be faced with paying for.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. It sounds like you talked about busing. What about the rail systems that are certainly a lot higher cost than that for any kind of repair or replacement than $3 billion over 10 years?
Mr. Kustra.
Mr. Chair, the state has a current contribution on the development of 10%. That would be replaced by this, and then also the ongoing maintenance and capital costs on the rail side as well. Again, we would expect under the current design for that to be shared with CTIB for the rail side. If CTIB dissolves, then it would be shared with the individual counties who would continue that tax. That's all part of the plan on the CTIB change.
Thank you.
Yep, and Mr. Chair, Mr. I would just mention again that it would also cover the state's operating costs for that. We're currently, the state is required to pay that 50%. That is where the state would be relieved from that from this point on. And we show that in this biennium, if this were to happen, that there'd be a savings of almost $37 million to the state currently, that otherwise we would need to come to the state to seek those funds.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quick question. Does this governor's budget include that the state would participate 50-50 in the operating costs of bus garages?
Mr. Kustra.
Mr. Chair, this takes the operating cost of bus garages off the state appropriations.
Okay. Thank you.
And capital costs as well.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, my eyes are and ears are captured in the same area and discussion that Representative Petersburg's were. Gentlemen, you talk about, well, if we agree with the governor and we go ahead and raise taxes on these seven counties by a half a cent on their sales tax, we're going to generate $3 billion over 10 years. You're going to relieve the state of all the costs for operating. We're not going to have to borrow and spend any more money for any more trains or buses or anything else. It all sounds really wonderful. And then I think two things. One, we saw, well, first of all, we go to page 38 and 39. I think you see what the future is. It's building more and more and more and more and more. I don't see where, gentlemen, you're talking about actually paying for more of the operating costs of these going forward, because actually we know that every one of these is a perpetual liability for the people of Minnesota, every single one you build. And your history tells us, go back right before session started, and suddenly there's a race on to build Southwest Light Rail and extend to the people of Minnesota and poke in the eye the legislature, who may not even been elected yet at that point, with the notion that, guess what, you're going to have to pay for this thing, and we're going to build it, and we're already hiring 60 or 80 people in your office down the street someplace. Why should we even believe you?
Mr. Kuster.
Mr. Chair, under the premise that reasonable people can disagree, I would say that these are assets to this region, and I think there's different opinion on that, but I will say that a lot of we are competing as a region here. We are going to see, one of the slides that we missed is we're going to have a growth of 800,000 people between now and 2040. We're also going to have expecting a growth of 500,000 jobs. That 800,000 is like two Minneapolises. It's like South Dakota. It's like North Dakota. All the people there as growth in Minneapolis. We have to respond to their needs. And the other piece of that is that we're seeing a greater demand for transit service already. Transit service demand and ridership is growing faster than population growth. That's a function of millennials, who actually 50% of which say that they look at the availability of transit as part of their decision on where to live. It's true of people of color, where we're expecting the demographic of people of color to change from 26% to 40%. They use transit at twice the rate of others, and we would expect them to continue. The elderly population is going to become from 1 to 9 to 1 to 5, and they will become more transit dependent. This is why businesses are supporting the development of transit services. This is why businesses are supporting Southwest, and it's why businesses are supporting bus, because they see how crucial it is to supporting the economic growth of this region.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Gostkowski?
I do, Mr. Chair, and thank you. You know, the more free stuff you give to people, the more they will want it. And all I can see is, on the part I can believe is what your plans are on page 38 and 39, and that is to build more and more and more if you're extended this sales tax. And it'll be more and more free stuff on the backs of people who don't ride it or who may ride it and actually pay their way to pay for people who don't want to pay. More free stuff. More people will come forward and want more free stuff. We can call that demand if you want, but that's just a natural human behavior. Thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on one of the, well, this map and then the other map you have. There's you talk about the next 10 years for funding a $3 billion investment. I see a big hole in that planning work for the Northeast Metro. And I just wanted to ask, what kind of investment plans do you have for that area? Because they face the same needs that people that live throughout the rest of the metropolitan area. And I see it as a real missed opportunity for strengthening our region. And I know that in Ramsey County in particular, people with the same education as people in the rest of the metro area make less income than the rest of the metro area, and I believe transportation could play a factor in that, or, you know, it's not the only thing, but it could play a factor in that. And, you know, when we get more income tax, we have more tax collections and those sorts of things. So anyway, what can you explain to me what your investment and your vision is for that area forthcoming?
Yeah.
Mr. Questra.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that you're talking about the upper right hand corner of the map and I'm imagining I'm going to look at Mr. Lamb so he can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that that is a function of the planning is a function of population density primarily. That's why you're seeing the expansion of the routes where you see the expansion of the routes and major corridors along there. So.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bernardi, when you look at this slide, we say at the bottom, additional transitways under development. That includes the rush line, which is being undertaken by Ramsey County, and so you just don't see that in our current map because we're looking for funding in order to be able to move that forward. But so the rush line would be included in this, as well as what Mr. Koester said. It is a function related to density, but that is also an opportunity for us to create density, and that's what we do through investment in park and ride facilities. So you would be able to see some additional investment in that area.
A follow-up, Representative Bernardi.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I also just want to mention Central Avenue has plans for in the future.
Yep.
And that has, you know, that's an environmental justice community up along a lot of that line. The 35W BRT, you know, projected in the future, that has high density too. So I don't believe it's just all density issues. I mean, as you get further out, I can see that, but we're really missing an important part of our metropolitan area, and I'd really like to see accelerated and paid a lot more attention to.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on hers, by the way, that's a sort of a chicken and egg thing. I mean, if you never build infrastructure there, obviously no one's going to move there. I can remember Mr. Bell, I think, one point when I was making the same complaint, he said, well, get people to move there and then we'll build something. But it's kind of like the Wild West town where the train didn't stop. If the train didn't stop there, they died. And so those decisions do have a kind of a chicken and egg thing. On page 30, the trends driving transit demand. Younger people are driving less. Millennials see transit as a quality of life issue. In 2040, 1 in 5 people will be 65 plus years old. As people age, they tend to drive less. That is so powerful, particularly the younger people, millennials, that every major business group has now written either letters to the editor or commentary in the paper, from Twin West Chamber to Minnesota Business Partnership and Minnesota Chamber, because they understand this, and they understand that that is really essential, an essential piece of keeping the economic engine of the state going. And it's in everybody's best interest to keep that economic engine going, because that money then goes all over the state, whether we're building broadband or wastewater infrastructure. But it's precisely that that makes me, on page 26, feel really painful when, and I know why the governor was driven in this direction. He had no choice because we weren't doing it in any other way. But to say that if we raise our own taxes, we relieve the general fund of operating costs and relieve the state's geobonding share. So this group of taxpayers gets to raise their own taxes so that we aren't a burden on the general fund and the bonding bill, despite the fact that we're going to keep right on funding all of the infrastructure for the rest of the state. And the, you know, the message is just painful to hear. And I know that you haven't had any choice, but it is one of those things that just feels like a sort of a catch-22.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. I did not hear a question, but I will give you a chance to respond.
Mr. Chair, I'll respond to the first part of the question that about the issue of demand and the changing demand over time. When we think about the regions that we're competing with, when you think about the Denvers, when you think about San Diego, you think about Houston, Seattle, and all these regions are recognizing the importance of transit development to their economic development of their region. Those are who we are competing with. We are the regional center for the upper Midwest. We're not just the regional economic center for Minnesota. And all those regions have a significant dedicated sales tax to this purpose, because they know to compete for federal dollars, you've got to be ready. And you can't be ready when it takes 6 or 8 years to develop the funding package. So that's the reliable part that enables us to compete for funds that are available to us through the federal government and other sources. And it really is a partnership, not only with the riders, but it's a partnership with the businesses who see the significance of this and making us regionally competitive.
Representative Lucero has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it is for either of the presenters. I actually had a question, but then I thought of another question here as I've been listening to the testimony. So part of the conversation involved the projected population growth into the future, and so my first question is, do your population growth projections factor in the population and job creator loss due to existing negative tax policy and the proposed additional tax increases, such as the governor's 16-cent minimum gross receipts tax increase, as well as the half-cent you're proposing?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, I'll respond in this way. I don't think that they're projecting population loss as an investment, as a result of the investment in transit. In fact, I think that if you look back at the Itasca group, who did a study on return on investment, and they looked at whether if we were implementing our transportation policy plan through 2030, that the return on investment for this region would be somewhere between $6 and $10 million. That's because they think it makes $1 billion. Sorry. That I understated it. That makes investment an asset to the region, an asset to business, and an asset. And business, if it's an asset to business, we think it's an asset to population growth. And that's our perspective. I understand your perspective.
A follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then there was a discussion regarding millennials and their demand for mass transit. You know, there's also, I think, an even higher demand, though, for transportation liberty or transportation on demand. And that's what we're seeing here with the technologies of apps such as Lyft and Uber, et cetera, transportation on demand, where they want it, when they want it, and then have destinations of where they want it. That's the demand that we're seeing in the millennials. And that's going to be overtaking, I think, any demand that we see in the future with 2040 projections of what millennials and others are looking for. So to my original question, in regards to commuter rail and bus, my understanding is that commuter rail and buses have a very similar capacity in terms of people movement, very comparable. So when considering the full capital cost, operating cost, maintenance cost, and depreciation for the life of each of those, what is the advantage of commuter rail over transit or bus transit?
Who wants to take it? I think we're going to have to take this offline because we are running out of time. I would appreciate you getting an answer to Representative Lucero at your earliest convenience. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, but I just wanted to make a quick comment. You know, we heard this term free stuff, and, you know, it's 40% fare box recovery. That's hardly free. And, you know, we have subsidies for roads, which I'm not complaining about, right? We have lots of subsidies for roads. You know, we just heard a couple of weeks ago, $1.5 billion property tax subsidy for local roads. But we seem to be getting into this pattern of pitting one mode against another. And that is not the way our state is going to move forward. We need roads. We need bridges. We need public transit. You want to see millennials using transit, I'd invite anyone in the committee to commute with me in the morning on the number 6 bus between 7 and 8 in the morning in Uptown. You can't find a place to stand because everyone is in their 20s and 30s. I'm the oldest person on the bus, the only one with bald hair, and I'll tell you that this is what the millennials are demanding. But my question is to that point. We have 40% of commuters in downtown Minneapolis taking transit. Have you done projections into the future about that number, and is it going to rise as we have more employment and hopefully, you know, as our core city downtowns grow? Do you have projections? Is that 40% going to rise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, our analysis shows that number will increase up to about 60%, from 40 to 60%. And because we also know with the region growing and with the it's going to be harder and harder to get into downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul. Again, right now we've got 30,000 people a day who are taking transit in and out, and as you mentioned, to take the bus from uptown. I'd invite the committee or anybody to come look at rush hour and see how the buses are lined up to go to Forest Lake, Blaine, Stillwater, Lakeville, Shakopee, wherever the heck you want to go. Those are all folks, professional folks, who are working in downtown who are able to take that transit to get home and get to work on a regular basis.
A quick follow-up.
Very quick follow-up. That 60% figure by when?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I believe that's by 2040.
Okay. Thank you
very much. Final question from Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Met Council and to the discussion here, we're talking a little bit, you know, why aren't we investing over here and investing over there, and, you know, those people need rides and this and that. But, you know, I think sometimes we miss the focus that, you know, we should be spending our transportation dollars to move people and move products as efficiently as possible. And sometimes, looking at some of these plans, it looks like we're utilizing transportation dollars to do economic development. And if that's what the purpose is, then maybe that's a different discussion, and we shouldn't have it, some of these modes that aren't as efficient, using transportation dollars. And as far as the proposed property taxes and sales tax increase, in the metro, in the governor's budget here, it might be interesting for people to know that you take a look at Denver, we have a significantly larger operating budget in the Met Council than Denver or maybe Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. or Seattle. And in fact, we have our operating budget is larger than 17 other regional authorities combined, with an over $1 billion operating budget. So I don't know that we have necessarily a complete money issue here, but maybe a little bit more of a priority issue on how we're using our transportation dollars.
A final comment, and then we will move on.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, members, to Representative Kosnick's point, I think we're going to have to follow up with him on that. I think that we may be combining Metro Mobility and some of the other services into that, where when you compare those to other regional systems,
thank you.
It's put together a little, little bit
differently. So any final comments, Mr.
Chair? No, I just appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Thank you for being with us today. We appreciate your presentation and the information you brought forward. There's some unanswered questions, and I know you're going to get us some more information, but we continue to explore the area of transit and transportation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Next, we will have a video. I don't know how many of you saw this when it was on broadcast television, but it does relate to Metro Mobility. It's a little bit alarming. I realize it may not be a completely fair highlight because it depicts what are fairly rare incidences, frankly, but it does give us a little bit of a peek into what's going on. And, we want these services to be done as well as they possibly can be and as effectively as they can and as safely as they can. And so we're going to play this today, not to embarrass Met Council, but to continue to put a little pressure on them to do even better than they already do. And as soon as our technicians get it ready, we'll have at it. Then we'll have a couple of testifiers that would like to address the issue, and then time for questions.
Metro Mobility is a taxpayer-funded ride service for the elderly and people with disabilities.
40,000 Minnesotans rely on it, but can they trust it to be safe? Tonight, a five-month-long Fox 9 investigation is looking into that question. Here's Jeff Ballion.
Yes, I need to schedule a ride for tomorrow.
Michelle Anderson never knows what to expect. Will her Metro Mobility ride be on time? What will the driver be like?
They're a bunch of speed demons.
Sometimes she fears for her safety. You never know, she says, if the bus driver will properly secure her motorized wheelchair.
There's been drivers that have not ever strapped it down and said that as long as it's off, it doesn't need to be strapped down.
It weighs over 50 pounds. Think of the damage you could do if the bus had to swerve or stop suddenly. Consider this Metro Mobility crash on 35W. Imagine the danger if there had been a loose wheelchair on board. Or even worse, if someone was in it. We found real incidents you don't have to imagine. This passenger's head slams to the floor when an improperly secured chair tips backwards as the bus speeds up.
Hold on. Yep. Hey, right. Oh, no. Hang on.
The same frightening scenario happened on this Metro Mobility bus. It can happen to people on scooters, too. The driver hooked up safety straps to this scooter, but watch what happens when the bus goes around a corner.
Jesus Christ!
The Fox 9 investigators used Minnesota's open records law to get a hold of these videos.
Oh my gosh.
They are...
Whoa!
Troubling to watch.
That's a real-life horror story.
But how often are people getting hurt? We asked Metro Mobility to provide the numbers. They told us since 2010, 9 riders were injured because of unsecured wheelchairs. Another 6 people hurt getting on or off of a lift. Here's an example of one of those. The driver wheels a passenger out of the bus to where the lift is supposed to be. Only problem, it's already been lowered to the ground. Metro Mobility claims the number of rider injuries is very small compared to the millions of trips taken. It says some are the fault of drivers, but most are not. For example, not all scooters and wheelchairs are compatible with the bus's restraint system.
I was scared to death of the lifts.
But we discovered at least 2 cases missing from the injury data we requested.
And I was thinking, oh God, oh God.
Sandra Klein was trying to exit a lift when it malfunctioned and her chair tipped.
Bam, I hit the ground. And
she broke her leg in the fall, spent a week in the hospital. But there were complications.
And I was told I'll never walk again.
Another rider, this one using a walker, also fractured a leg falling from a lift.
They told my client to walk, which she did, but before she was completely off of the lift, the lip was raised up and they essentially tripped my client and caused her to fall down.
Why were these cases left out of the injury numbers we asked for? Metro Mobility says it was an oversight and not an attempt to withhold information. The Metropolitan Council owns these buses but contracts with private companies to provide the drivers. They're always looking for help. Last year, the turnover rate at one company was 51%, 42% at another. You don't need a commercial driver's license to get behind the wheel of a Metro Mobility bus. Starting pay is $14 an hour. Riders told us there are plenty of very good, courteous drivers and some not so good. We found 244 unsafe driving complaints have been logged against Metro Mobility since 2015. One contractor fired 67 drivers last year.
Some of them drive like maniacs. You know, they drive too fast.
It was easy to find some examples. We couldn't keep up with this driver. We backed off after our speedometer hit 72. This bus was having trouble staying in its lane. We don't know why. Drivers are human. They make mistakes. This one backed into a parked car. What got him fired was the run after the hit. Not someone you want taking grandma to her doctor's appointment. No one from the Metropolitan Council, a public agency supported by your tax dollars, would agree to an on-camera interview to answer questions about Metro Mobility. Instead, we got a prepared statement. We work daily with our contractors to ensure customer safety is front of mind and that we are taking every precaution to prevent injury. You can read the full statement on Fox9.com. Drivers are also reluctant to talk publicly. But privately, some told us the demands of the job have never been higher. Some put in 10-hour days. There are more people using the service. Ridership grew 6% last year, a pace that's expected to continue as the population ages.
And that means even more drivers will be needed in the future, a tall order given the already huge turnover rate. The Met Council blames a vibrant job market in the Twin Cities as one of the main reasons why it's hard to hold on to good drivers.
What a story.
Yeah, that was my thought, though, is there's going to be a lot of demand on that system because there are more and more riders.
It's already a lot of demand, and one of the common complaints you hear from riders is they're late for appointments. But Metro Mobility says we're on time 95.
We have a couple of testifiers. First, Michelle Anderson, would you like to come down? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Michelle Anderson, and I ride Metro Mobility quite often, and the experiences that I've had are very alarming, and I've been on when they've told me that they don't need to strap my chair in as long as it's turned off. I've had difficulty having to schedule rides, and it's just not been a safe experience for me. I've been discharged from physical therapy because of being brought in late to my appointments for 90 days because of Metro Mobility. And I just have not been very happy with the service that I've gotten from them.
Thank you for your testimony. Does anyone have any questions for the testifier? Representative Sundin. I'm sorry, Representative Mason. My fault.
Are there other options that you use besides Metro Mobility?
Ms. Anderson.
No, there are no other options for me, because if I was to take a cab service, there are no cab services that are handicap accessible to me, and so my only option is Metro Mobility or the city bus. And some of the places that I do have to go to are very far, so it would take me numerous buses to get to where I need to go.
Okay. Follow up, Representative.
No, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Anderson, maybe a couple questions. How many years, I can ask this in one time, how many years have you been using the service, and have you seen over that period of time it's progressively getting worse? Are you seeing an issue with the driver quality? I'm just kind of curious what you're seeing in the length of time you've used the service.
Ms. Anderson.
I've been using Metro Mobility for the last 4 years because at that time I became a below-the-knee amputee. And I've had to use their services. And it's just progressively gotten worse. And sometimes the drivers, they just don't care. And in order to get me to my appointments on time, they've had to speed above and beyond the speed limit. And I've had experiences where I've gotten to my appointments late, and I've been unable to be seen. So I still have to sit and wait until my scheduled pickup time comes up and then be picked up. I asked for call for an earlier pickup time. They refused to do that. And it's unfair to me because of their negligence, and I don't feel that that's fair. And when they're late, they always say that they get me there on time, in which they don't. Or when they come to pick me up, I'm sitting and waiting, and I see them across the street at another building, and they tell the dispatcher that they're there to pick me up, and I know that they're not because I'm on the phone with the dispatcher, and I can see them across the street at another building, and they say that they're there, and I said they're not there. Because if you're there to pick me up, your job is to come in to get me and to bring me to the bus. Well, there's no bus and there's no person, there's no driver to come and get me. So their jobs have slacked off. And one time I had to be there in the morning and the office wasn't even open. So I had to sit outside and wait until the office opened up. And I don't feel that that's right either. And just recently, I was at Winkley Orthotics, and their office closed at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I had to sit and wait, and their receptionist had to wait until 10 minutes to 5 until they came in to pick me up. So I just see things going downhill and things that are not, I feel, appropriate.
Thank you. I don't see any more questions. Ms. Anderson, thank you for being with us today and sharing your story. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Neumeister, I believe, would like to make some remarks.
Okay. I'm with you all the way on this. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and for those people who may not know who myself is, I know a lot of there's new people here, but I'm a citizen who's been lobbying up here for decades on issues of public accountability, open government, and privacy. I also happen to be a Metro Mobility driver for 30 years. Since 2012, I've not been driving for them. I was also involved on the periphery in South Minneapolis when Project Mobility got its start. It all rests with you, leadership and accountability, and what's happening with 40,000 people that are being driven by a private contractor where $52 million of money is going. There's never been a legislative audit review, a program evaluation, and a review of a 42 or 41 history program for the most vulnerable adults. So that would be my key thing that I would suggest to you, is to get the legislative auditor to do a program evaluation, because the facts are there, where, like, for example, a lot of electronic engagement. As you know, I do a large amount of work on privacy. So I know about GPS. I know about electronic monitoring. Drivers are driven by the electronic system. And if they're falling behind, they get add-ons all the time. So there's pressure on that side also. Secondly, when you have a large turnover rate, that to me is a big issue. Thirdly, what is the relationship between the contractor and the Metro Mobility Council in oversight? I will say that there are some issues there, just by some of the requests that I've done on data practices over the years on this issue. Now, Mr. Chairman, I know that there are a couple bills going through. Your colleague, Representative Kosinski, has one, as in the other body, Senator Kiffmeyer does. But even on those two bills, which just ask for a task force, by talking with some folks, there's already discussion about not even having an outside task force. Let Metropolitan Council do their own study. I very much encourage, based on the testimony of Ms. Anderson and some other folks who would like to, but sometimes don't have the opportunity or are afraid to, or don't want to say something because they may lose their ride or they're fearful of retribution, I think it's just time for a legislative auditor, eval. And I think I've interacted a lot with legislative audit evals on issues, you know, when they've come before the council. And when I look at them, this, I think, would be a high priority. But it takes leadership and some time for you to come up with some ideas and some targets and some goals. But I think it would be a very worthwhile one to do.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. I do not have any questions from members for you. This is a tough issue. As you know, we've seen the projected growth in this area, and it's skyrocketing, frankly. So the need certainly continues to accelerate. At the same time, the challenge of providing this service in a safe and timely manner becomes even more of a challenge over time. So, Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, that's where, over the decades, this legislature, and I've been here for four, rely a lot on the legislative auditor to try to crack some of the tougher nuts that need to be cracked. And so I think you've made the case right there to maybe just think about the possibility of a legislative audit review, whether it be a review program or something, for the future. Thank you very much for your time and allowing me to make comment back.
Thank you. And members, if you haven't turned in your auditor sheet yet, it's, I forget the due date, it's this week, Friday of this week. Representative Salk.
You still have a minute?
Yes,
I just wanted to pursue. So you said you were a driver in this system?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Neumeister.
Representative Salk. When did you last, or are you still in this employment scenario?
2012 is when I left. I was there from 1983 to 2012.
Representative Salk.
One more question then. What's your experience relative to, in the context of that we are going through a societal labor force issue, and this is one of the places where that comes to bear. It comes to bear at personal care. It comes to bear at these kinds of specialized services. This, for society, this is a challenge. And I understand the reticence of people to say money is the solution. So if I take money or salary away, do you have other recommendations that you think actually would allow for better performance?
Mr. Chairman, and I, even though we just recently met, Representative Salk. I'll just say from my own experience by talking still constantly with drivers, pay is important, and pay is increasing. At least I know that one provider is a union, and they do get good wages, but the issue is the pressure. And they feel that they can't give the attention because several years ago, I know that some of your colleagues, former colleagues, and they may still be around, took some rides on Metro Mobility, and they saw how, to some extent, pressure it was. But now, you don't get your sheets of paper now. Now you've got to look on the computer. Oh, you've got to add on because you're in this area. And then you're running behind already. And so that's where, I mean, I can share with you. I mean, I've sped up historically. You know, when I know, but hopefully I'm doing it safely, and it's a pressure job. So the less pressure, and that's what a program evaluation can do. Where are the holes? What are the issues? And then because of the turnover, at that certain point of time, sometimes you'll have less drivers, but the folks don't go away who need the service, who need to get to the doctors or any of their social to engage in a good life, that it's important that we in Minnesota has historically provided to people with disabilities.
Representative Howe.
Representative
Howe.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know exactly where this question goes to, but I thought at one time back when this was all drivers in-house at one time, I thought, and then they went on strike, they provided National Guard drivers, and then I don't know how it got to this stage of the game. I mean, I used to drive for the St. Cloud special services buses, so I have an understanding what it takes to do this job. But how did that transition get to the way it is today with contracted providers instead of in-house drivers?
Thank you, Representative Howe. We're going to make this very short because we don't have time for an entire history lesson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howe, and probably from the mid-80s until the mid-70s, until 83, the Metropolitan was done by Metropolitan Transit drivers, the regular drivers who drive the bus. In 1983, they basically contracted out to a lot of social service providers, about 14 of them. In 1993, then they went down to three. And there's some issues there, and that's when Arne Carlson called up the National Guard. Because I remember helping the National Guard get around to places because they didn't know how to get to places. So they were doing the driving, and they came in, and I just, you got to go this way, that way. So that's real quick.
Thanks.
And so we've been contracted ever since.
Yeah, we could have a much longer discussion. We have Nick Thompson here from Metro Transit, and I'd like to get him up before we run out of time. We have about 10 minutes left in our session this afternoon. Thank you both for being with us today. Welcome to committee, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're in the hot seat.
For the members, again, my name is Nick Thompson with the Met Council. I think I spoke to you a few weeks ago describing the Met Mobility Service and the differences and challenges, and I'm happy to answer the questions you have today. Customer safety is the key goal that we have for that system. Reliability, we strive to build safe systems into how this works, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. So talk a little bit more about what systems are in place to assure rider safety.
Mr. Chair, members, as you've heard stated, we contract out this service. So all the providers of the service for Metro Mobility are private sector, with the drivers are responsibility of those companies. We have within the contract some rules around what they have to do for riding safe training. All the drivers that are hired are screened, background checks, drug and alcohol tested before they are allowed to drive. They go through rigorous safety training prior to being a driver for the first time. That includes how to drive, how to operate, how to strap in wheelchairs or other devices, how to properly secure. And then they have monthly reports or monthly training on safety to reinforce that. If there's any, as you saw with the videos, we have good systems in place to monitor the operations. So if any customer has a complaint or if there's any report of injury, we have the ability at the Met Council and so do the providers to go and see exactly what happened and take corrective action. The contractors are responsible and required to report incidents in a timely manner. We structured the contracts in both a carrot and a stick approach. We put incentives for safe driving records and safe operations, but then also we have some penalties for any safety issues.
Mr.
Lazzi, that's it in the broad terms.
Could you describe the challenge of securing these carts and scooters, et cetera, in the buses?
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the so each bus that Met Council purchases, the bus and the safety equipment within that is we buy the best secure mechanisms on the market, but the problem is there's different devices. They're generally designed for wheelchairs, but as you saw, there's scooters, a lot of different types of devices, and so not all of them. There's no standard for a device to have some way to secure to this attachment. The drivers do offer to have the passengers, if they feel that it'd be more secure, to move to the seat where they can wear a seatbelt. But that is the passenger's decision. It is not something that can be required by the driver to move them to the seat.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. A few days ago, we heard from Teamster that said he drove the equivalent of back to the moon and back 2.5 times. With a safe driving record, and now we're struggling with people being paid $14 an hour. I think the starting wage or average wage at McDonald's is like $15 an hour. There's very little incentive to retain these drivers, and I think we should have a hard look at what those people are reimbursed and maybe up the ante a little bit and have more incentives provided for them to maintain that job and do a better job.
Any comments on wages,
Mr. Chairman? We did mention this a couple weeks ago that we are considering that the driver wages are an issue, that we would have to increase the wages to attract and retain drivers, but of course that has a budgetary impact. What I would like to say is this is a very safe system. We had 29 accidents with injuries last year on 2.2 million rides. So any injury is one injury too many, but it is a very safe system for drivers, passengers. And we also, we can't compare to other, these are system services that are provided in all the major metro cities around the country. We're one of the safest systems out there if you compare it to similar sized cities. So though we definitely are concerned about any injury, I just want to reassure committee members that this is, you know, the track record is a record of safety.
Representative Salk, a quick question. We're just about out of time. I have one more testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Do you or your contractors have specific outlines that they should audit their drivers, for instance, ride-alongs, some sort of training period where they would ride along while watching some, that kind of box of kind of activities?
Mr. Chair, Thompson. Members, yes, the providers have a regimen of how they bring on new drivers, how they monitor drivers. They have observations out on the street so they can see, and then they have these tools available through video and tracking and data and performance that they have excellent information that they can, if any customer complaint, they can investigate and have very good information about their performance. But they also have checking and other things built into their operations so that they, as a mechanism of safety.
Thank you. A quick follow-up?
Yep, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want you to know that there is no chance that I want anybody to think they could walk around, follow me, and tick off every single time I'm making an error and or a human judgment mistake. And I know that you have a world that is with human beings. And so please don't misunderstand my attention to silly suggestions and that sort of thing. I understand the difficulty of your position.
Thank you. We have another testifier. If you could introduce yourself for the record, sir, and go ahead with your testimony.
I'm Joel, and I want to talk about the computer systems. When they are down, they are down. People struggle with overtime, all the pressure, and everything else. The GPSs work for about 10 minutes when the computers are down, and they have no backups. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson, would you care to respond to the issue of the system that actually dispatches these buses and how it's working?
Mr. Chair, members, it is a very sophisticated system for setting up rides and setting routes. It's a system that relies on technology. We have had chances or occasions over the past months where the system has went down, and that affects the customers. And so this is one of our mission-critical systems that we see on the system. We put all the attention we can do to get that back up and running as fast as we can. But like technology, there has been times, any time does affect the customer service.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Representative Baker has a final question.
And Mr. Thompson, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think when we sit here as public officials, we take a lot of heat. When we do make mistakes, we've got to face the camera and face the music. Part of what disturbed me most about this is that you didn't go on this interview and this camera to say you do have some safe operations, and you didn't make a better statement to the public, which affects all of us. So I just, maybe my only statement is, if you could do it again, would you have maybe addressed it a little differently? Because we have a public trust issue that we need to address. I know your job is complicated. I'm an employer as well. But I just think that we need to face the music, and we need to make sure that we do a better job letting the folks know right when it's there what is working and what isn't, and actually owning it. So would you do it different if you could do it again?
Mr. Thompson, before you answer that, I just want to thank you for facing the music today. You've come forward, and we do appreciate it. Would you care to answer President Baker's question?
Mr. Chair, Representative, for 5 months, we worked on this story with media. We many times talked to them. We provided a tremendous amount of information. We answered every question they had. In the end, we made the decision. We could spend 5 seconds on the camera. We'll provide a full statement, which they incorporated, which covered all the issues and the comprehensive and the complex nature of this. So if I had to do it again, I would do the same, because we were able to get more information out than we could have in a 5-second soundbite.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson, for being with us. Members, we'll be recessing as we're coming back this evening. We have 9 bills on the schedule starting at 5 p.m. I look forward to, it might be a little later, but we'll start as close to 5 as we can. I look forward to seeing you all tonight. Representative Fabian noted this morning in environment that hunger makes people move a little faster, so I'm not bringing pizza. We are recessed.
Of after 5 o'clock has already come, so let us get started with the meeting. I will reconvene the House Transportation Finance Committee, and I believe the next agenda item is moving through some of the bills that we have in front of us. And first, we're going to deal with House File 1659. Representative Anselmo, is he here? Okay. Welcome, Representative Anselmo, and I will move that House File 1659 be referred to Ways and Means to get it on the floor, and please introduce your bill for us.
Thank you, Chair and committee members here. I'm here to introduce Bill House File 1659, which deals with traffic congestion. There are two things that people in Edina really don't like. One is losing in the high school hockey tournaments, which fortunately our women's team did not do this season, as they won that for the first time. And the second thing is being in lots of traffic. So this bill is going to hopefully work on a pathway to reduce that. This bill is authorizing appropriations for funding for the I-494 Commission, which is a joint powers organization that makes up member cities Bloomington, Richfield, Edina, Eden Prairie, and Minnetonka. And really, it affects anyone between St. Paul and Shakopee that drives down I-494. This commission was put together in 1986, and it has dealt with I-494 congestion issues as it relates to getting people to carpool and working on formal methods to do that. Today, we have a testifier that is here, Eden Prairie City Council Member Brad Aho. He is a member of the I-494 Commission, and he will introduce and testify in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and please identify yourself and who you represent for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brad Aho, and I serve on the Eden Prairie City Council, and I am the current chair of the 494 Corridor Commission. I'd just like to start out by thanking Representative Anselmo for authoring this bill, as well as Representatives Loon, Rosenthal, Carlson, and Hornstein for sponsoring as well. So I've served on the 494 Corridor Commission for the past 12 years as I've been a member of the City Council, and the commission really is really focused on solving transportation issues in our district, as Representative Anselmo said. And so we hired a staff called the Transportation Management Organization, or a TMO, to really help businesses and residents provide information and incentives to encourage transportation options other than driving alone. So the TMO engages over 900 businesses with their employees to help them provide discounted transit passes, and we also hold on-site commuter fares to help formulate carpools and vanpools and assist with transit and bicycle commuting route plans, all with the effort of trying to reduce congestion on that corridor. We also assist MnDOT with communications and route planning during road construction projects, like our current Highway 169 construction project where we've got it shut down. And so people really look to us to help them through that. Our primary focus, again, is to reduce congestion in the Southwest Metro area, and we're focused on increasing person and goods throughput, getting more people to use existing infrastructure by means or alternatives to driving alone, as well as advocating for infrastructure improvements like the 494-35W interchange. That is a highly important project to us. Getting right to the point, the Commission currently receives its funding from two sources. We receive federal congestion mitigation air quality grants, or CMAQ grants, and we also receive a local match from each of our member cities. The CMAQ grant money flows from the federal government through the Metropolitan Council, where there have been changes to what activities CMAQ eligible expenditures. And so those changes really have the result that our member cities and cannot make up the difference, because there's been a funding gap due to those changes. And so what we're really here for today is to have this bill seek some state appropriations so that we can continue our good work and good results. And I know you have in your packet kind of the results of our work in front of you. And so you'll see that we do a lot of great advocation for transportation and congestion relief. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing us to be here and testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee? Is there? Yeah. Representative Renbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for ringing the bell. I just am curious if your member companies regard their employees' time as one of their greatest assets. And if so, I mean, you know, that might trigger some additional kinds of efforts. And I might pass along to you a resource that is doing work out in Washington State where they actually are encouraging employers to give incentives to their employees to move closer to the office. Now, we don't have, congestion like Seattle does, but, you know, it's an interesting concept.
Well, that's a good idea, and I'd love to see that resource. We do work with the employers and really try to find any alternative. So we do a lot of work with telecommuting, helping employers to find ways for their employees to telecommute and stay off the roads completely for business purposes, as well as through carpools and van pools and bus passes and transit passes.
Representative Renbeck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it would be interesting to hear a report from you, but we don't want to make you do a report, so well, at least not today.
I mean, you pretty much have a sheet that indicates kind of the results, and we work, like I said, we work with over 900 companies. We work with Best Buy, Starkey Labs, all big companies. So we actually have a quite broad reach beyond what just is our five member cities, because we're working with residents that commute outside of our area and businesses that are located in our area with where residents or employees are coming from outside of our five cities to commute to those locations. So we have quite a big reach beyond our five cities.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Is there anybody from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Hornstein, you have a question.
Just a comment, and I appreciate Representative thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Runbeck's comment, and I understand that there has been some collaboration with different corporations and companies and public sector folks on this e-workplace initiative, and they've had, you know, some conferences and some work that's been done on that. So apparently it may not be ongoing, so it's something we may want to look at as a committee. Representative Runbeck, because I think your point is very well taken, and there has been some work here already, but maybe not to the extent that we need to do it.
Thank you for your comments. I think that's very appropriate. Any other questions or comments? If not, I will renew the motion that House File 1659 be re-referred to Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails, and you're on your way. Thank you, Representative Anselmo, for bringing your bill together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Pecker.
Thank you. I think we're going to take House File 122, Representative Nash, next. And while he's coming forward, I will move House File 122 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Nash, if you would like to share
House File 122. Good evening, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for having me in today. House File 122 is all about motorcycle safety and training. There's two components in there. I'm going to be addressing one of them, and my testifier will be addressing one of the other ones. Many of you, I look around and see familiar transpo faces from the last 2 years. You've seen my prop before, but this is a Start Seeing Motorcycle license plate, and the provision in the bill provides for the creation, or in actuality, the printing on demand of license plates that will be purchased by people who are either sympathetic to the Start Seeing Motorcycles issue or themselves, like Mr. Reba here, big-time motorcycle owners that own lots of toys and want to promote safety. And this motorcycle license plate is really all about that, and I want to share a story with you about one of my constituents who can't be here. Her name is Mary Berger, and a couple years ago she was in a motorcycle accident by somebody who, after the fact, said, "I just didn't see you." And members, that's the goal behind this, is to begin driving awareness of people on motorcycles. You know, I have shared this joke before. I want a motorcycle. My wife has changed my mind on many occasions and has said that I actually don't want a motorcycle. But if I did have one, it would have this license plate on there, but only with your help. You know, we drive around and we just don't always think about it unless you make it very much a mental thing. And that's what I'm asking for us to do. The practical upshot is the bill provides for these license plates to be sold at a cost that puts money into the motorcycle safety training fund, and it puts money into the state fund in order to actually handle the printing of motorcycle license plates. And in the past, they were manufactured. Now, with the new technologies that we have, you actually just print a license plate, and you can create smaller batches of them so you don't have lots of them on demand and sitting on a shelf waiting for them to be purchased. So the provision is very simple, and I know we could actually talk through the financials if Mr. Lee felt like he wanted to, but you can also just look at the fiscal note that is included in your packet and recognize that it actually does make the state money and puts money towards the motorcycle safety corps or fund. The other provision, this is Mr. Todd Riva. He is almost a constituent of mine. He's stuck with Representative Hoppe. But I would like for him to explain the other provision.
Please go ahead and identify yourself for the committee and continue on with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Todd Riva, R-I-B-A. I am the Legislative Director for American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education, and some of you might know us as A-Beta Minnesota. We are the largest motorcycle safety advocacy group in the state, and our members believe that the best crash is the one that doesn't happen, and so that's why we're here today. I just want to quickly touch on that motorcycle license plate just a little bit. There are 400,000 of us that have motorcycle endorsements in this state, so that's a pretty good potential customer base. My mom and dad are not registered motorcyclists, but they'll have one of these plates. Representative Nash is training me to say when we get this passed, not if we get this passed. But motorcyclists also drive cars, trucks, vans, so there's a good customer base out there, and you can bet that if or when this bill is passed, A-Beta Minnesota, we will use all of our resources to promote the sale of this plate. The other thing about that plate is it's that motorcycle safety fund. It's that $10 per plate that goes into the motorcycle safety fund, and I'll talk about the value of that in just a minute. So the second part of the bill deals with endorsement fees. Many years ago, motorcyclists of Minnesota, a long time before I started coming down here, asked to have a dedicated fee added on top of the endorsement fee that they pay to ride motorcycles, and they wanted it to fund the motorcycle safety fund. So this dedicated fee, at the time, they said, well, you can have up to $750,000 of that dedicated fee. Beyond that, it's going to go into the trunk highway fund. So about the time I kind of started coming around, I want to say it was maybe 10 years ago, we asked to have 100% of the dedicated portion of the endorsement fee that we pay. So every time we renew our driver's license, just like all of you, we have to pay the same fee that you do, and then on top of that, we have to pay that motorcycle endorsement fee. And so what happened when we asked for that 100% of the dedicated fund over the $750,000, they said, well, you can have 90% of it, but you can't have 100% of it. So over the last 3 years, that 10% that we didn't get to put into the motorcycle safety fund has been somewhere in the neighborhood of $15,000 to $20,000 per year. I know that you all see figures a lot bigger than that, but to us, $15,000 to $20,000 is a lot of money. Just for instance, the state of Minnesota has four different levels of motorcycle safety training. The basic course, or the beginner's course, the state provides the motorcycles. And we know, as A-Beta Minnesota, that we've helped purchase motorcycles for that course, and $20,000 could probably buy about three of those. So that's pretty significant. There's a big cost to the upkeep. So that's our concern, is it's a lot of money to us. You can buy a lot of bumper stickers, a lot of PSAs. There's a lot of good stuff you can do with $20,000 per year. So we are asking for 100% of that dedicated fee. And I just want to tell you quickly, Bill Schaefer, the Motorcycle Safety Coordinator, is here. somewhere. If there's any questions, if anybody has any questions about the Motorcycle Safety Fund. The Motorcycle Safety Fund helps fund subsidized motorcycle training classes. There's four levels, beginner, intermediate, expert, and then the advanced, or they change the names quite a bit, so I lose a little bit of track. But there's four different levels depending on your skill level. When I first started hanging out with my fiance, she decided she wanted to ride a motorcycle, and at that time I'd been riding for about 15 years. I took no motorcycle safety classes. So we were at the Mall of America, and we were leaving, and we had a little miscommunication with a bus. And she was ahead of me, and I watched my fiance brake. I watched her release the brakes and swerve, and then I watched her hit the brakes and avoid the Jersey wall. And Bill's over there going, yep, that's the way you're supposed to do it. That's when I kind of thought maybe I should take one of these. Since then, I am married to my fiance now, and I have taken six of these classes. And my fiance and I are taking two more this spring. I had an experience myself when I was riding. I unfortunately was a little bit unprepared to have another motorcycle pull out in front of me. So I wasn't as prepared as I should have been, but that motorcycle pulled out in front of me. And I, with confidence, used the skills that I was taught at that advanced course. High-speed brake, high-speed swerve, and I avoided that crash. So the value of those motorcycle classes, the public awareness, all that good stuff, in our mind, helps us avoid the crash. And like I said, the best crash is the one that doesn't happen. So, Mr. Chair, members, with that, I want to thank you for your time on behalf of ABATE Minnesota.
Thank you, and I think we do have at least one question. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill forward again. My family started selling motorcycles, snowmobiles back in 1971, and I was involved in that business until 88. Sold, serviced, and raced motorcycles for pretty much all that time, a little bit afterwards. And there's so many times you're driving down the road, and you know, I raced a lot of motocross, and motocross you learn to watch out where the other guys are. You might be fine, but the other guy might be trying to take you out. So I drove on the highway just like I did on the motocross track, and I never had an accident. A lot of close calls, but never had an accident. I had so many miles by the time I was on my bike. By the time I was 15, we had a driver's training in Bagley, Minnesota, about maybe 12 students and one instructor. And about half a day into it, the instructor would tell us something about how to do this and how to do that. And they'd look at me and go like, is that right? So after the second and third day, I was actually really honored that he had me help teach the class. Because it's so much more than just, you know, how to start, how to stop, how to turn. It's being aware of your circumstances and making sure my reasoning was there's always got to be a way out. If a car's coming up to a stop sign, you don't know if he's going to stop or not. I had my best customer in North Dakota. Really a fun guy. Enjoyed life to the fullest. Did some crazy things. But he was going to a small town in North Dakota, doing the speed limit, going into town from a 65 down to like a 40. And he ended up getting rear-ended and killed. Instantly, because the guy was doing by 80 miles an hour and didn't see him. So if this bill will help, you know, prevent one of those accidents like that, it's going to be well worth it. So you have my full support.
Was there a question in there? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to your committee.
It's good to be back.
Well, Mr. Chair, question I have, and maybe the author can answer this because I didn't see this last year, but is this a license plate for the car or a license plate for the bike?
Mr. Chair, Nash.
And House staff can feel free to correct me as necessary, but it could be for either. So it could be for a full-size plate or it could be a motorcycle-size plate.
Okay.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I know the barn doors and the horses are already gone on this, but I know back when I first started in the legislature, we kept hearing this different plates, and I don't know how many plates we have now, but I know the public safety officers, police, and the troopers around the state have concerns about being able to identify plates, and we have so many now different plates and specialized plates, and in the past, there was more of a cost to them, but it's just, we have so many plates that sometimes the officers, when they have to identify the plates, can't tell if it's a Minnesota plate or not. But that's, I think, again, that's something that the horse on that's already out of the barn, and it's kind of late probably now to close that barn door to stop that from happening, because we've been proliferating these in the last 2 years. Many, many more every year. It seems like we have 2, 3, 4 plates, new plates that people want to have, and almost to the point where you want, probably should get put everybody's picture on their plate, and everyone have their own personal identified plate.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative Nelson, it's a good question. It's a very fair question, and beyond the actual manufacturing of the plates, because that's changed with technology. I did want to know what the answer to that question was, so I talked to my local sheriff, and I said, Sheriff Olson, what do you think of this very question? And he says, you know, Jim, we're trained pretty much whenever there's a new plate. Our officers are very good at making those quick identifications. I'm always amazed at how quickly police can just look at something and it just registers very quickly. That's what they're trained to do. He said that from his perspective that, you know, a new plate is just a new plate. And that they'll figure out. And this is just a mock-up, so who knows what it's going to wind up looking like. But it's something that they're trained to deal with on a regular basis. And I know Mr. Ariba wanted to comment on that question as well, because it's a very fine question.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I agree with you. There's a lot of plates out there. We've been kicking this thing around for quite a few years now, and we keep kind of getting the door slammed in our face. When the golf plate came out, that one, we kind of took that a little bit personal. But I will say that this plate, out of all of them, this is the only one that is dedicated to crash prevention, and it's the only one where the funds are going to go to traffic safety. And like I said, we got 400,000 of us out there, and we are going to do everything we can to promote the sale of this plate. Currently, the Motorcycle Safety Fund, the only source of income is from motorcycle endorsements. That's it. We're not asking for any other money from the state, but this would be a nice little shot of money into that Motorcycle Safety Fund. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And Mr. Chair, if there are no other questions, we're happy to stand for questions, but I know that you're on a tight schedule.
Thank you, Representative Nash. I think I can run my own committee.
I'm sorry.
I just have one question myself. If I put a plate that big on my motorcycle, it's going to look kind of stupid.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, we have talked to Thomas Evans from the Vehicle Service Supervisor of the Special Plates.
And he was talking
to this. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not going to be this big. But
thank you.
We have specifically talked about the design, and we are kind of kicking around some ideas.
And I look forward to seeing it, and maybe I will buy one of the appropriate size for my motorcycle when it's available. I see no other questions from members. The motion is to lay this over. Your bill is laid over, Representative.
Thank you, member.
Thank you for being with us. Next up. Next up is 1822, Representative Petersburg.
No.
I don't know who made the Special K bars, but they are my favorite. Representative Petersburg, do you know the motion for your bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1822 to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you. Go ahead with your bill.
File 1822 is something that we heard again last year. It made it into the tax bill, but obviously we're here redoing it. And it really corrects an issue related to the legacy extra sales tax. As the law states, and I have Mr. Cummings here from the Department of Revenue who will go in more detail, but basically the statutes are clear in both directions that 3/8 of a percent of all sales tax needs to go to legacy fund, but it also says that all sales tax for vehicle sales tax has to go into the Department of Transportation. And so this just corrects that 0.38%. And I will turn it over to Mr. Cummings, who will give a more detailed explanation.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Cummings. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Chair Torkelson and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I'd like to thank Representative Petersburg for carrying this provision this session and the previous session. This provision was identified for the Department of Revenue staff as a needed clarification for the tax code. As Representative Petersburg mentioned, this was carried in the tax bill that was passed but not enacted at the end of last session. Before I explain the issue, let me just state clearly that while legacy funds are referenced, they are not raised or lowered due to this proposal. For most purchases in the state, when 6.875 is collected, 6.5 cents on the dollar gets transferred to the general fund, and 0.375 on the, cents on the dollar gets transferred to the legacy funds. Mr. Chair, under current law, for motor vehicle lease purchases, businesses across the state collect and remit the sales tax based on 6.875 of sales price. All of the net revenues, or 6.875, must be deposited then, you know, in various accounts, the general fund, county state aid, highway fund, and the Greater Minnesota Transit account. However, the state constitution requires that 0.375 also is transmitted to the legacy funds. Therefore, 0.375% of the revenue that is collected is transferred into the legacy funds, and 6.875%, all of the net revenues, is transferred into the general fund, the county stated highway fund, and the Greater Minnesota Transit account. While these transfers are directed under statute, the result is a total transfer of 7.25% of the revenue from the motor vehicle lease purchases from tax collected from customers at 6.875%. The calculation of the net revenue and resulting amount to be allocated to the county stated highway fund and the Greater Minnesota Transit account should be based solely on receipts from the tax imposed under the 6.5 rate. The 0.375% collected for the legacy funds on top of the 6.5 rate would continue to be collected and transferred to the account. Currently, due to the transfers of 7.25%, which is above and beyond the 6.875% collected, additional money is transferred from the general fund rather than taking from the transportation or transit accounts. This is not a wholesale change in policy. Rather, this is a correction to ensure the revenues collected under all parts of the sales tax are being recognized under their intent. Thank you for hearing this bill, Mr. Chair. As Representative Petersburg said, I believe the next stop is Tax Committee. And, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with you on this bill, and I know other important bills that will be coming up this session.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Representative Kosnick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wonder if Mr. Cummings or perhaps Mr. Petersburg, Representative Petersburg, would want to comment on the difference in sales price with the legacy funds, whether you purchase a vehicle or do a long-term lease, and why we don't just have the lease vehicles be similar to a flat-out purchase and maybe eliminate that whole problem, and if that might be a good amendment for your tax hearing.
Mr. Cummings.
Well, Mr. Chair, and maybe I'll be corrected, but I believe that the motor vehicle lease purchases are under Chapter 297A, and the motor vehicle sales tax is under 297B. So the motor vehicle sales tax is was not affected by the legacy funds and is still charged at the 6.5%. So this ends up being a constitutional issue, whereas the motor vehicle sales tax was not impacted by the legacy constitutional amendment, from what I understand.
Mr. Cummings, the likelihood of you being corrected by anyone in this room is quite slim.
Well,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Runbeck has a question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cummings, I don't think that the amendment, certainly, maybe the bill then that carried the amendment clarified that, but where was that, all that detail about statutes? Was that done after the passage, or just, I mean, how did that all transpire?
So the details in which I'm talking right now?
Right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Cummins, so there's two chapters. One affects motor vehicle sales, and one affects other sales.
Yeah.
And so was that part of the original bill that in which the constitutional language occurred, or was that done by the legislature after the passage?
Mr. Cummins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I'm not sure that as the legacy amendment was being discussed, it anticipated
right.
the motor vehicle lease sales tax. I know that there was another issue that has been dealt with related to the state airports on sort of
Then, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Cummins, then there had to have been some legislation, and was so it's a legislated issue, not anything that was contained in the constitutional amendment, would be my guess, but I'm not a tax expert.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummins.
So I think part of the issue becomes is that before the constitutional amendment passed, you know, the term net revenues fully meant the 6.5% that was charged for sales tax across the state. But now when we have the legacy amendment that was imposed on top of the 6.5%, the meaning of net revenues, we believe, have meant all of the revenues, meaning 6.875% of what is collected. So while that, because the constitutional amendment imposed that additional amount, we believe that net revenues then changed from 6.5 to 6.875. And we're simply looking for clarification so that we have this, the amount that is collected is equal to the amount that is later transmitted.
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, I mean, it does sound like it's a legislatively been interpreted. And anyway, we should perhaps check with some of the legal tax experts around the House.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the question is became that the legislature put into the statute that the full amount of the sales tax for vehicles, the lease vehicles, was going to go into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund prior to the enactment of the constitutional amendment. And so legislatively they did that beforehand, but the constitutional amendment didn't make that distinction, and so because that was the only one that specified that everything goes into the HUTD, it became then complex because the constitutional amendment says, but we will add on the 3.7 whatever percentage, 3% onto that, and so therefore it got to be the confusing issue. And so the constitutional amendment kind of trumped the legislative, and now this is attempting to make that legislatively corrected.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would we have someone from House Research possibly?
You know, I'm a farmer by trade, and I didn't realize the weeds could be so thick we could actually get stuck in them. Representative Runbeck, if you want to go further into this, you're welcome to, but I'm keeping an eye on the clock.
Okay. I would think we could take a minute and just see if there's some...
At President Runbeck's request, I am asking for more information. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. I think there are two issues that are kind of being discussed. I'm going to deal with, I think, the one that's most important, which is why is there an issue with this double dipping of the legacy tax as it relates to long-term motor vehicle leases? And it's because when the statute was when the legacy tax was first enacted, there is a provision in the general appropriation language for sales tax that says all of the dedicated monies that come out of sales tax, like for, there's a section, 297A.95, I believe, that basically dedicates, lists all the appropriations that come out of sales tax. And there is a provision in there that says these appropriations to specific funds do not include the legacy tax. Unfortunately, the long-term motor vehicle sales tax dedication was actually in a separate part of the statute. It was not in the general appropriation language, and so it got left out. And that's why we have this problem, just as it relates to long-term motor vehicle leases.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, it's I don't know if I understand it any better, but it seems like it's an interesting one to explore.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I do not have any other questions. Would you care to make any closing remarks, Representative Petersburg?
No, Mr. Chair. I just ask for your support, and I think this is one of the things in which we do to make correct issues that we find as we come across them. And so I would also renew my motion to refer this bill, House File 1822, to the Committee on Taxes.
All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed on to taxes. Next up, we have Representative Spaczynski with House File 2061. The motion on your bill, Representative, and I'll move it, is to move House or to refer House File 2061 to taxes. Do you have an? Is the amendment yours, Representative Spaczynski?
I believe it is.
A1. We will. Do you want to take this up to get the bill in the fashion you want it?
Yes.
I'll move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Your bill is amended. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As you know, the state of Minnesota is not. They don't have to pay sales tax, but the unique situation when it comes to lump sum contracts is have been affecting all units of government, would be the state of Minnesota, county governments, city governments across the board. I've been carrying a few different bills to give some tax relief when it comes to construction materials for counties and cities and when they're doing sewer projects, and it seemed only right and fair that we'd make the same argument for our state infrastructure when it comes to transit and our road construction. This bill, House File 2061, accomplishes that goal by utilizing some of the tools that we helped develop with some of those other bills when it comes to those lump sum contracts. So that's when the contracts that are let by the state of Minnesota include both labor and materials. There was a court case, I believe, in the early 80s that where the state of Minnesota, the Department of Transportation, sued to try to reclaim that ability to not pay taxes on that. But they lost that suit with the idea that the companies that are doing the work on behalf of the department are taxable. And so we're using the tools where if you have a project that you bid, you pay certain amounts of sales tax on those construction materials, the concrete, asphalt, gravel, whatever that might be. You save those receipts, and then you, through a form to the Department of Revenue, turn those, the taxable entity, which would be at this point the state of Minnesota, take those receipts on behalf of their construction company and turn those in and then get refunded that tax. And those dollars would stay in the trunk highway fund where they belong rather than get ciphered out. I think you get the drift of what the bill does, essentially. This does include one of the areas that we did look at. We do have a fair amount of federal funding coming into transit projects. We do capture that as well. So as they're buying track and rail and buildings for people to stand in, all those funds would stay within the system and not get pilfered out through the rest of the state in the general fund.
Thank you, Representative. I do not see Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Is this kind of like a wash if we're not paying taxes and it's for the state? Or is there a cost to the state to do this?
Representative Spaczynski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mason, you know, that's probably the most unique part of this. Taking from a wash standpoint, we would simply be keeping it in the trunk highway fund or the fund in which those dollars originated. So it would go essentially, so the contractor would bid the job with the idea they're going to pay the sales tax, and they put that in their bid. Then they pay the taxes, and then at the end of the job, because the entity, which would be at this point the state of Minnesota, is tax-free, if we put this bill in, they'll take those receipts, and on a yearly basis or by a contract basis, take those receipts, they'll match it in with the plan. So the idea is that you just don't say we can't pay taxes. The revenue has a problem with that, with the idea that these contractors sometimes do jobs, maybe they're putting a private driveway in. What we don't want is those same contractors kind of beefing up their pile in the yard, essentially buying tax-free concrete, tax-free mix and whatever, and then using that on private projects. And so the unique part of this bill is that by using that receipt system, the application that then goes into the Department of Revenue, be able to really do a very close analysis, make sure there's not any fraud involved with that, and that money, is, rather than go just paid to the general fund, gets returned back into to the Department of Transportation.
Thank you.
And so this bill also does that to the counties, too. So as the counties do the same work, this money would get pushed back into the same. So up and down the line, whether it be at the state level, local level, as they're spending this money, we create the same situation up and down the board so that we keep more dollars where they're, I mean, that's where the dollars were generated through the state gas tax.
Representative Drazkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swazinski, do we know, is there a revenue note on this bill, and do we know how much the counties and the cities are saving in tax, sales tax, and are they acknowledging that in lieu of the discussion around LGA and County Program 8?
Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, Chair Drazkowski, we have yet to get a revenue note. We have done some work just on the napkin. You know, if you look at total transportation funding and take 60% roughly of the total amount that we're spending on transportation, research would be able to point that you to that number. You know, a lot of the dollars are flow-through dollars, and then the rest of the dollars, if you're a city below 5,000, those are all local property tax dollars that are generated and then put into roads, except that a few instances where the state has put, you know, $12 million, $20 million into local small cities' roads and money, that would actually... That this bill would essentially capture those dollars as well and allow those dollars to be used at the local level if they're spent or generated at the local level to put back into roads and critical infrastructure rather than they pay the sales tax. It goes up to the state and it may or may not get recycled back down the pipe.
Follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Swazinski, I appreciate and support the approach. Just the question is, the counties and cities keep telling us we need more LGA, we need more CPA, and we provided them sales tax exemptions in the past 3 or 4 years in multiple places. And then here's another one that is going to help them and give them some wiggle room, which is good, and it keeps the money locally, which you said you can use on roads and so forth, which I think people support. But we need to remind them when we do these things as a legislature about the savings that we're providing for them in the whole discussion around LGA and CPA.
Chair Torkelson.
Representative Swazinski.
Representative Drazkowski. I think there is a hair bit of difference. You know, with this tax relief, it will not necessarily be distributed in a manner that LGA or one of the other programs or county program aid is. You know, that's kind of a general program. So it really depends on the age of infrastructure. So if you've got a city that's already done a lot of upgrades to their sewer and their water or their roads and their bridges within their city state, they will not see the benefit as much as a city that maybe has pushed off some of these upgrades. And so it's kind of a little bit different the way the formula would work together, because if you're going to do a project, you would see a little bit more of that benefit from a bill like this. So just on a side note, you know, just the construction materials from a city and a county, which would put it in, or would, I think that is about 20-some million dollars. That's a conversation that we can really have with those entities if we're to move something like that forward, to say, hey, this is going to save you, but it's not, you know, it is a separate, I believe to a point it's a separate conversation, but I think it's within the same genre that could be made, that it does help with local property taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. I do not see any other questions. I renew my motion that House File 2061, as amended, be referred to the Tax Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You're on your way. We will, or where is it? Oh, there it is. House File 1264, Representative Rarick.
Just want that on the record. I love it. It's such a little word.
Representative Rarick, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move file 1264 to be laid over.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 1264 was brought forward in an effort to try to help resolve an issue we were having up in northern Pine County. We have a small volunteer fire department that is looking to use some buildings located on a MnDOT property that are currently not being used so that they can store some of their firefighting equipment so it will be closer to residences and places they need to respond to. We're struggling at times to get everybody together, so Senator Lori and I decided to come forward with this bill to try to help speed the process along. We have some concerns from MnDOT. I spoke with them earlier today, so I believe their representative is here to speak to that, but we are going to be working towards addressing that issue. There is a radio tower on the property that they have spent some money on to install, and Pine County uses some of the services of that tower as well. So our intent is not to take that away from them. We will definitely work with MnDOT so that they will have access to the tower and be able to use the tower, but we really would like to get it so that the fire department has the ability to lease these buildings and store their equipment there.
Thank you. I believe the department would like to testify. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Burdine with MnDOT Government Affairs, and as was indicated, this site currently has a MnDOT communications tower on it. The property was acquired for $28,000, and the total cost, including construction of the tower, is $750,000. So we would certainly like to protect that investment. I do have a map of the site, if that would be at all helpful for folks to look at. So this is part of the ARMR system, or the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response, which has state and local emergency response communications. MnDOT has granted the fire department a lease to use the property and the outbuildings that are not currently being utilized. You'll see on the map also that the DNR currently has a lease to store a trail grooming piece of equipment there. The department needs to be able to maintain access to that site, and there's, as you can see on the map, there's only one way to currently access the property, and the tower is kind of in the back portion of the site. And there are instances when outages or failures occur on the system, and so then our staff needs to be able to access the site immediately. And also, as was indicated, the Pine County Sheriff, as well as Duxbury Fire Department and DNR and other emergency management service agencies use the communications tower for their communications as well. So one of the concerns that the department has is that ice does form on the tower at times, and large chunks of ice can fall off. Because some of these buildings are so close to the tower, that's a concern of ours as well, that we would potentially then be liable if a chunk of ice fell off the tower and were to damage one of the buildings on the site. So certainly we'll continue discussing this with Representative Rarick, but just wanted to express some of those concerns on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rudine. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I have for either the Representative Rarick or Mr. Rudine is, this, on the map here, you got a leased area 40 by 10. Is that the area we're talking about the fire department using, or what building are we talking about? What area are we talking about that they're looking to purchase or to use?
Representative Rare.
Mr. Chair, I believe it is the existing garages is that the fire department is wishing to have long-term use of.
Mr. Chair, if I could add,
Mr. Udy,
that the leased area and the hash marks there is actually what the DNR is currently leasing to store their trail grooming equipment, and so the DNR also paid to have that electric meter installed at that location. But and as Representative Burke indicated, it's these other buildings that the fire department is interested in.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and I, without being able to see what the property looks like, I guess it would maybe it's a common sense thing, but in the front of the lot there, onto the, I guess to the left of the driveway, as we're looking at the map, would be more appropriate place for a building that'd be farther away from the tower, if they were, you know, if that could be worked out instead of using the existing buildings, if that's a concern. I guess I don't know if that's been discussed or not, but I'm just looking at this, and when I understand the concern of we want to make sure that the armor tower that we have use or access to it for repairs is necessary, because that's the backbone of our emergency system that we have in the state of Minnesota. But, I mean, it looks to me there should be some way to work this out between the two parties that we're not affecting one or the other, and I don't know if this is the way to do it by, you know, buying the land and then, as the DNR, or excuse me, the DOT says, if the ice comes off and damages something, now the DOT and the state of Minnesota is liable for it. That seems problematic also. So, I mean, there's got to be some way to work this out.
Representative Rarick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, and that we're going to continue working. This bill is being laid over, so we're going to continue to work with Mr. Udine and the department and the fire department to make sure we cover everybody's interests. So,
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Udine, can I just ask, what currently is the department using these facilities for, these buildings?
Mr. Udine.
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, the department does not use the buildings currently, and so it's my understanding that we have a lease with the Duxbury Fire Department as well as others to use these buildings, since the department has no need for them.
Mr. Lee has a clarification for the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair and members, I just got a note from the agency that the fiscal note, which shows a $2,000 cost in fiscal 18, is the number is incorrect. It is actually a $7,000 cost starting in fiscal 18 and continuing in 19, 20, and 2021. This matches the description on page 2.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. I do not have a question from Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Rarick. Is the Duxbury Fire Department currently using this building?
Representative Rarick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe they have some access to it. They are the ones who contacted me and Senator Lori, wishing to... not recalling if it was long-term use, so that they knew. I'm trying to remember if the issue was that it's 1 year at a time, and they don't know exactly if they're going to be able to keep that. But I believe that was the issue, that they're looking for a long-term solution, and that's...
Representative Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rare, thank you for that. My background is in commercial real estate in New York City, and it seems to me that the department has significant investment in this land already. So it seemed that maybe we could do it the opposite way, and for that $100, you could have a 50-year lease or a 100-year lease or something that would satisfy both parties.
Representative Barrett, any comments?
Mr. Chair, and I think ultimately that's where I'm hoping this ends up.
Thank you. I will renew your renew my motion that your bill be laid over. Next, Representative Whalen.
If there's any submit, move one of these buildings to here. Get it far enough away from there. Okay.
Welcome to the Transportation Finance Committee, Representative. We have before us House File 1434. I will move that we hear House File 1434 to be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment. You should have that before you. So I'm not sure if you want to move that first or...
Thank you. Representative Whalen moves the A4 amendment to get the bill in the condition she would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Your bill is amended. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before you is the result of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report on MnDOT's project selection process from 2016. Just briefly to the amendment, I'll speak to that first. That came about in response to some questions I had regarding some of the provisions that were actually taken out of the bill. So one thing that was not recommended by the OLA report, we ended up deleting a section that currently requires MnDOT to report on one project in-state and one out-state on their environmental mitigation and compliance costs. And I reviewed that and found that in the Metro, they chose a project along Highway 5. The environmental and mitigation cost was 8.8% of the total project. And then outstate along Highway 14, they chose a project, and that was 5.1% of the total project costs. Just looking at that information in and of itself, I didn't find particularly useful for making legislative policy changes. And so in conversations with others, we drafted this amendment that requires MnDOT to report on environmental and mitigation costs and their whole environmental review process to identify and summarize primary laws governing environmental review, compliance and mitigation activities, which must include calculating the per project average costs, total annual costs for at least the previous three fiscal years, and a breakdown of costs reasonably attributable to compliance with state and federal law, compliance with administrative rules, requirements, or agreements with other state agencies and departments, relevant activities undertaken under the discretion of the Commissioner and environmental mitigation and remediation actions. And they must also identify efficiencies and options for reducing trunk highway project costs associated with environmental review, compliance, and mitigation, which may include but is not limited to potential legislative changes or administrative rules. So that's the amendment, and then to the underlying bill. Before I go into details, I just want to thank the Office of the Legislative Auditor, members, and others who have worked with me on the bill. We've had some great conversations. Again, in summary, the bill is designed to reflect the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report on project selection with particular focus given to the Corridors of Commerce program. In brief, I'll just share how the lack of transparency that was highlighted in the report affected my district. There was a project that was chosen by the Transportation Program and Investment Committee at the last minute to receive funding over several highly ranked and similarly priced projects in the Metro, most notably U.S. Highway 10 and Armstrong Interchange. That project, which did eventually get funding, which was the work of a lot of folks, and I was very thankful for that, but that project had the highest return on investment of all evaluated projects, yet it was not chosen. And so based on some recommendations from the OLA report, which includes, let me back up a little bit. Sorry. So the bill is not an indictment against any one particular person or persons. It is, however, an indictment kind of against the culture we face with departments, which I think is an issue that extends beyond MnDOT. There seems to be a deep-seated lack of trust that exists with agencies and the legislature, And while we may still have some work to do, I'm hoping this bill is a step in the right direction to help us rebuild that trust. So to the bill, as an overview, sections 1 through 3 are designed based on recommendations on alternative project selection. Specifically, if you had the OLA report, page 59 noted MnDOT did not select corridors of commerce programs in a manner fully consistent with the law's requirements. So this cleans that up a little bit, section 3. And then sections 1 through 3. Section 4 is based on recommendations from the OLA report that MnDOT should track local spending on trunk highway improvements. And I have some examples from the OLA report if members have questions on that. Section 5 is based on the recommendation that the legislature, because the legislature frequently directs funding toward projects that create new infrastructure, MnDOT should develop a planning process that enables it to prepare for such projects. And then Section 6 and 7 is based on the recommendation from the OLA report that MnDOT should increase the transparency of its decision-making process, particularly by providing information to enable comparisons between projects that are selected and those that are not. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have an Anoka County engineer here with me to speak to the bill, as well as, if members have questions, a member from the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Thank you. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Fisher. I'm the Anoka County Engineer and Transportation Division Manager. Thank you. When this program was created by the legislature and funded by the legislature back in 2013, we were very excited to see this as a way of getting projects that weren't currently in the State Transportation Improvement Program, or the STIP, to allow other projects not in the STIP to be supplemented with funding so that they could be delivered and to make those capacity and safety improvements that we see around the state. Because, as Representative Whalen mentioned, that because Highway 10 had such significant problems, we are very confident that this would be another grant program that we would be competitive in competing for those fundings. But as the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report indicated, we were disappointed in how the program was launched and projects were selected. Unlike most grant programs, even a lot of the grant programs that MnDOT does have, such as their TED program, Transportation Economic Development Program, if it's a safety grant or a congestion relief grant or an economic development grant, there are generally a lot of criteria and objectives and data that goes into making them an objective selection of those projects. And that's what we're used to. But as this program was launched, the Corridors of Commerce program was launched, it really didn't have that objective criteria. And I think that's what the Legislative Auditor's report indicated. And as Representative Whalen went through, that's the purpose of this bill, as amended, to make this more objective, have a defined criteria, because a lot of times when we submit for different grant applications, if we get funding, great. If we don't, we at least know where we stood in the rankings. Were we 15th? Were we 50th? Where were we? And again, that gets a little, if we lose, it's a little easier to accept if you know, well, there was a lot of other really great projects that got funded. Just a couple highlight some of the aspects of this that Representative Whalen went over. Section 1 does pertain to, this really is a program to add new projects to the STIP and not to partially fund projects that are currently in the STIP that are seeking additional funds. So this really, by having that three-year gap, because nobody has shovel-ready projects anymore, very few shovel-ready projects. This, though, is that extra money to get some of these projects in that state so that they can be funded and built in a short amount of time. Section 2s and 3 are just kind of some of the key provisions of making the program objective. I think Section 5, the reports, 5, 6, 7, are talk about reports, and I think there's a lot of really good information that can be gleaned from these reports. The one report about, what projects didn't get selected and how did they score compared to the ones that did. the local money that's spent on trunk highway system. I think this could be some very eye-opening information. We spend a lot of our county dollars trying to help MnDOT solve trunk highway problems. And then to the amendment, I think this is very important because everybody says, well, a lot of these environmental regulations and work-related regulations are federally funded, so there's no way we can get around them. But I think you've heard before that there's also a lot of what I call self-imposed regulations, and those are the regulations that the state passes that are over and above what the federal ones. And I think this report gets to that says, okay, not only are these the costs of these environmental programs or wage programs or DBE programs or the like, but what is the difference between what the feds require and what are required by the state? And I think that's very important information. So I think that amendment is very, very appropriate. So I just wanted to, I'm just here to relay from a local perspective. Again, we thought the corridors of commerce program, and we still do feel that this is a great program to have. And again, we just hope that it would be a little more transparent and objective in the project selection. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. I have a question first from Representative Johnson. Ms. Guzzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a few questions. I'm looking at page 1 on line 1.15 and 1.16. Representative Whalen, am I reading that right, that the project couldn't start until at least 3 years later? Or do I have that backwards? Help me out.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. So as Doug, or County Engineer Fisher, was saying, that part of the problem we're finding with the current process is that it's looking for the Corridors of Commerce program wants to help with projects that aren't shovel-ready quite yet, and so that's what this is specifically getting to, and then I think I'll hand it over to County Engineer Fisher to explain a little bit further.
Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, yeah, the whole concept of the Corridors of Commerce was to give MnDOT money to do more projects than are currently in the STIP. And if you are funding projects that are in the STIP, you know, they're going to gobble up this money. You know, maybe they're $25 million short of being fully funded. Well, that, you know, is this the program to fully fund those projects, or do you want this program, as intended, was to add projects to the STIP, new projects that weren't in the STIP. And so it allows local agencies to partner with MnDOT to maybe they need some right-of-way acquisition still, or maybe they need to move the final design or something. It was to promote more projects over and above what currently was in the program. And so if you don't have that three-year gap, I think, and what we might have saw in the last program was the money that was for this really didn't go to new projects. It just helped fund those partially funded projects to get there, which really, I thought that should be a different issue altogether. Not, this was to create more projects.
Just before you go ahead, Mr. or Representative Johnson, I have to get something clear in my own brain. So does this legislation affect only Corridors of Commerce? Or are we, because we've been talking back and forth between Corridors and STIP and STIP and Corridors, and you've gotten me confused.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this section specifically does relate to statute or section 161.088, which is the Corridors of Commerce program. And the STIP and the Corridors of Commerce program was for new projects that were not currently under development or trying to be funded. But what we found was, what the OLA report found was, that some of the money from Corridors of Commerce was going to funding for projects that were not new or not really what Corridors was meant for. That's my understanding. Corridors is meant for new projects, so we want the money to go to projects that have not actually started yet.
Thank you. So this legislation is directly related to Corridors of Commerce.
This section of the bill, Mr. Chair. Yep, the bill itself, there are other sections that relate to other, the project selection process as a whole as well.
No wonder I'm confused. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's interesting to hear that interpretation, and maybe Representative Hornstein can better refer to this, but I was in the committee as this program was developed, and that's not the way it was designed. Actually, it was, I think, to identify expansion projects that couldn't find their way into the STEP, that everybody in that region knew were very ready to go. And this this kind of flies in the face of that. But even more so, the next question is on page 2, line 2.22, where you're removing the language of regional trade centers. Again, if where I live, I think this was the hope of the corridors of commerce, is that there was a recognition of the need for regional trade centers. Now, you got to get outside the metropolitan area. You got to think out in the countryside where there's regional centers that are isolated because they don't have adequate road systems. And the corridors of commerce was finally a breakthrough on that. And to pull that language out of there is, you know, would really fly in the face of what we're trying to do. And it'd be interesting if they read this in New Ulm. I think they'd take notice of this. Why did you choose to remove that language?
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We, in conversations with nonpartisan staff when we were drafting this, that did come up, and so I'm going to ask Matt Burris to address that question. Thank you.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, one of the requirements in the Corridors of Commerce program for projects that are located outside of the metropolitan area is that the project is on an interregional corridor. So the drafting change, or the change in the bill to eliminate reference to regional trade centers, is in the context of the evaluation criteria that need to be established for the program. And so that's in the context of one of the criterion, which is on connections to highway systems, transportation modes, and regional trade centers. That regional trade centers is made redundant by virtue of interregional corridors being part of the eligibility for the program in general. So there wouldn't be any additional connections to regional trade centers over and above what the eligibility requirements are under the program. So the intent was to clean up a redundancy as opposed to make a substantive change on what kind of projects would get selected under the criteria that are established in the language here.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, Mr. Burris, you know I deeply respect you. But I really, the words regional trade centers really, where I live, get to the core of what the corridors of commerce is about. Because it's not only about connecting highways, it's connecting economic activity in rural Minnesota, where we need economic activity and we need further development. And this was the opportunity to take advantage of regional trade centers, where we probably have our greatest hope for further economic development. So I would really, obviously I have a lot of problem with that language. And my last question is then, are there any restrictions in this bill that would restrict, taking it back, when the Corridors of Commerce money was appropriated, we did do that back in 2013 and 2014 with $330 million plus a little bit, were allocated to Corridors of Commerce, and the first $300 million was not, the second $30 million, the last $30 million was designated towards rural Minnesota as part of an arrangement with some other funding going on. But the first $300 million, the understanding was that about half would be spent in the metropolitan area and then half outside the metropolitan area. Is there any, and that the idea was that the benefit of regional dispersion of the funding. Is there anything in this bill that would keep MnDOT from doing that in future allocations of corridors of commerce money?
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe so, but again, I might refer to nonpartisan staff just to clarify and make certain.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, no, the bill doesn't make a change as to the split or any kind of limits between how much under corridors of commerce would go to the metro area versus greater Minnesota. And that's not specified in the current law language, so that was part of the agency practice in setting up the program, but is not laid out or changed in law.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is specifically about Section 9 and the A4 amendment. And I think, and Mr. Fisher, thank you. I remember 14 years ago when you were coming here quite often when Representative Queasley was the chair of the committee, and you've added a lot, and I appreciate your contributions and your comments about the Corridors of Commerce program. But you had mentioned in the context of discussing some of these federal regulations, I think you used the term get around them, and I hope ultimately that's not what we're trying to do with A4. But what are some examples when you talk about environmental review, and this is either for the author or Mr. Fisher, is it primarily environmental awareness worksheets? Is it full-out environmental impact statements? What are the types of environmental review that you typically encounter in your projects?
Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, there's a whole myriad of environmental, economic, social aspects that we're required to do with transportation projects. And again, it can be from anything from wetland impacts to noise, air pollution, anything, all kinds of environmental ones, but the social ones too, environmental justice issues and so on and so forth. But what this gets to is not getting around anything. It's reporting what are the costs associated of that project on the environmental review and the difference between what the federal requirements are and the state requirements. So it's just a reporting. It's not a getting around.
Right.
It's not saying we're not doing this. But if the federal wetland impact requirement from the Corps of Engineer was a 2-to-1 ratio for impacts, but because of the State Wetland Conservation Act, it's a 3.5-to-1 ratio, that would be the difference that, the report could show that the federal, as Representative Whalen said, 8% of the cost of this project was regulations. Well, was it 5% regulation federal and an additional 3% of Minnesota-imposed regulation? I think that's what the reporting would try and identify.
Representative Hornstein.
Just real quick, lots of different reporting requirements. But when you typically have to do environmental review, does it tend to be an EIS or an EAW or neither? Or what do you typically have to do in that specific instance?
Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, it all depends on the project and the extent of the project. I will say that at the county level, we have never had a project rise to an EIS, an environmental impact statement level. Most of our projects would be an environmental assessment worksheet, which is almost as in-depth as an EIS, but it's not. There are those thresholds by law that require, if you're doing this type of project with these type of impacts, that, you have to do this review. So no matter large or small, if you're using, state or federal money, you're going to be doing a very in-depth environmental review of that project, everything from archaeological sensitive areas to, again, wetlands, floodplains, air pollution, noise pollution, noise walls, so on and so forth. So, and that's very prescribed. You have to do, if your project does this, you have to do this. But it will be different if you're doing a St. Croix River crossing project as compared to a county state aid highway reconstruction project in an urban area. The reviews, we still have to review the same items, but to a different extent and with a different result sometimes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm very interested in this. What we come up with in Section 9 will be very important. And it's a little bit of a misnomer, the environmental awareness worksheet. A worksheet implies like something you did in fifth grade and homework assignment. It's a little bit more involved than that, but not quite as. But there is a significant difference between that and an EIS. Sometimes I wish we would be doing more EISs instead of EAWs, but they don't stop projects. That's very important to know.
and just slow them down.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to agree with Representative Clark on that, on my confusion about taking out the regional trade center thing, because it does seem to say something much more specific that I don't see anywhere. But my high anxiety is, I seem to recall when the legislative auditor was making their presentation that I found myself feeling some sympathy for MnDOT, in that we have one project selection process and then we get another good idea and now let's lay down another project selection process, and then we criticize them because they don't seem to be reflecting all the needs. But now here I worry when I see House File 1434 and House File 1241, and both reference more work that we're going to do on the project selection process, and I worry that we never get rid of anything. We just layer another layer of something over it, and pretty soon we have what some term in some governance circles, balkanized mess. And I'm hoping, you and I have had a conversation about corridors of commerce already in its future, that maybe all of these pieces that you might have an opportunity to pull together around a table and understand how they all relate to one another.
Thank you, Representative. We share a concern. I didn't hear a question, however. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to go down the road of why that language is pulled out, because I think that this sets up a structure based on the words written that I think that really should be there yet, and I don't know in terms of where we are in the process how much impact we can have on it. But if you read this as it is, it says project evaluation prioritization must be performed on the basis of an objective criteria, generally meaning that you're going to set a scale and enumerate the benefits across that scale for any of the given characteristics. Just to take your point that because this is talking about regional centers, that somehow that word is duplicitous, I think that one has to look at the fact that the statement is asking for an objective criteria on the strength of the connections between the commercial centers, because there clearly can be such a great improvement in connection at the commercial centers, between commercial centers, that it would drive the evaluation objectively up to the top in terms of the other criteria that are here, or one that could be relatively foggy, if you will, be very indistinct as to the connection for regional centers. So I'm working more on the creating a scale, an evaluation that's objective on the word connections, not on the regional centers part. The regional centers is just telling us between what and measuring what benefit. So that we may have to agree to disagree, but I think that there's sufficient structural English driving why that would be included.
Thank you, Representative Saul.
Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Whelan, there's some parts of this bill I see some benefit of. The report on the environmental and what these things cost and how they drive cost or don't drive cost can be a good report to have. And the idea of about having the selection process, having the transparency of what a project is or is not picked, where you are on the list, I can see some benefit in that, in this, and so that you know, and maybe then you can see all the other projects out there and maybe have a better understanding why your project wasn't picked. But as I look at this bill and a few of the other ones we've seen here, some ways this reeks to me of, my project didn't get picked, so I'm going to fix it so that next time my project is going to be at the top of the list. And I'm not saying that's what you're doing here, but it reeks a little bit of that. And it's just a symptom of the greater need that we have in the state of more transportation funding, that we're here, all these projects are grabbing at the crumbs that are out there and trying to muscle their way to the front of the line, and we have this huge list of bridge projects and road projects throughout the state that need funding that we don't have enough money to do it, and we're trying to figure out ways to push our project forward. And like I said, there are some parts of this I think are good. So, but this is more of a comment than any question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Whalen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for your comments. And I will say the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor kind of just gave extra footing to what many legislators were already feeling, which was a misunderstanding or lack of understanding, I should say, with the project selection process, why projects are chosen or why others are not. I was not alone in that and wanting to understand that. So as I stated in my opening comments, the bill is in no way an indictment on a particular person or persons and which projects were or were not chosen, but rather it is an indictment upon the culture, and there is a seeming mistrust between legislators and the agency, and I want to rebuild that. I had a great conversation with folks from MnDOT in my office. They agree with a lot of the recommendations that were in the OLA report. I'm sure you probably saw Commissioner Zelli's response to that. He already agreed to do much of it. And so we're just putting those recommendations into statute. I did also just briefly want to address the comment about the regional corridor piece that it seems to be causing a bit of heartburn, which is absolutely not my intention. If members would like to speak with me afterward offline, I'm willing to work on that, willing to address that to ease that concern. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Whalen, thank you for bringing the bill. You pretty much reiterated some of the comments that I was thinking that, from a transportation policy perspective, I thought this was a great bill to bring up because we need to better prioritize and figure out how we do select projects, whether it's in corridors or commerce or a couple of the other projects. So thank you for bringing the bill. I think it's a good step forward that we need to do to help maximize our transportation dollars.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment, since many of us were here when the bill was formulated, I just remembered why we were doing it. And it seems like this is changing it, and plus the fact that it is trying to skirt around MnDOT's original priority list in the second place. So is it really, I don't know if this is helpful or whether it's something that we just need to just dissolve, period.
I did not hear a question in there. I have no more questions.
The point I'm trying to make is...
I'm not trying to cut you off, Representative. Okay. If you want to make a point, go right ahead.
The question, is this bill needed if it changes the original intent of the corridors of commerce? And if it's doing that, do we need to dissolve the corridors of commerce if we can't do what we were trying to do in the first place?
Thank you, Representative Mason. Well, finally, Representative Bernardi, no one else on your side has failed to speak, and now you're going to. I was concerned.
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Sundin, I hope you're thinking of something to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been working with Representative Whalen, and I appreciate her effort on these things. This I just want to clarify this part that this new amendment that I just became more familiar with now that you added it. Wasn't part of the OLA report, correct? Right. And then, Mr. Chair, I know Representative Whalen is always interested in getting people's input and making the bill better. I definitely want to talk with you about this because one of my concerns is identifying inefficiencies and reducing project costs. I think that we always want to be efficient with our money. We also want to be effective with our money, and sometimes just reducing costs doesn't mean that it's a benefit to the state. So cost benefits, I think, are super important to what those additional costs that might be. They might be of great value to Minnesota, and so that's what I want to make sure that's not lost in there. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Nothing to say, Representative Sundin? All right. Thank you. I have no other questioners on the list. Thank you for a thorough evaluation of the Whalen bill. I renew the motion that House File 1434 be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, President Bernardi. Representative Bernardi, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1155 for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill.
To be laid over.
To be laid over, right, thanks. For possible inclusion, yep. Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I have before you today is House File 1155, and it's a Performance Measure Implementation Plan for MnDOT. This has bipartisan support, and I'm very appreciative of the people that have worked with me on this bill. I'm bringing it to you today with an amendment that I would like to move that delete all amendments, which is it A170158? I don't know how you want me to address that.
Bernardi moves the A17 amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Your bill is amended.
Thank you. And so what I did is, after meeting with Representative Torkelson and Representative Runberg, I simplified the bill. So I went through and cleaned up a lot of the language and just, so there's not any, I don't think that there's anything new that was added, but it was just cleaned up to make it easier for people to understand. So I'll just briefly walk through it with you to give you a feel for what it is. And it's regarding a performance measure implementation plan. I think it's important for us as a legislature, when we do give more money to MnDOT, that we just make sure that there is accountability and transparency in how we're doing our transportation system. So with this bill, it would have to comply with our federal and state laws, but I think the important part is it would tie into our goals of the state. So what MnDOT's doing, it ties into what we as a legislature have directed MnDOT to accomplish. And with that, it's expected to do it, and it's just has a little bit different look now, so I'm not as used to looking through this one. But it focuses on all of our modes of transportation, and it also includes doing an inventory of our assets, which would include but not limited to bridge, pavement, geotechnical, pedestrian, bicycle, and transit assets. And then it would work into predictive and consequential performance measures. It would look at what would be our targets for those performance measures, and this would be in consultation with the public, and then set up annual performance targets, identify where we are at the end of the year with the gaps, and then an important part that we would want to have included is the life cycle and risk assessment, including remaining service life for each project of the district or the department. That's been talked a lot about MnDOT, about how they would like to move towards remaining service life. They've been working on it for a long time, and this would put it into law. And I didn't bring the maps with me, but you often have seen my maps, or the maps that I've shown before, with smoothness showing green all over the state, and then remaining service life, it's some green, a lot more yellow, and red. And I think it's important that we're tracking our remaining service life. And just a little tidbit, in about 2000, 2001, our remaining service life of our system was over 15 years, and now we are down to a little over 9 years for our remaining service life. And I think that's really important for the public to know that, because it helps build a case for why we need to have the funding to maintain our transportation system. And then the other one is the annual investment plan for each district of the department, based on the funding expected for the 10 years. Then looking at a financial sustainability plan, which looks at what trunk highway segments should be removed or added to the system, because there is a cost to that, and it's important that we stay on top of that. And then at the end, that they need to submit it to our committee by the commissioner, and that it needs to be signed by a professional engineer. I did meet with, and this would be an annual report, I did meet with MnDOT yesterday, and we had, we do have a fiscal note. Last year it was $10 million, so I must say, let me just say this. This was the old bill in its former format. I actually did delete parts of the bill that MnDOT's not really good at yet. They're learning about it. I know they've done studies on things, but I took all that out because it's not extra, trying to reduce the effort that would cost them a lot of money. And originally that bill last year was $10 million as it stood. And then I saw this year it got down to $9 million. And when I met with MnDOT yesterday, we went over the bill that we currently have done, and we've been able to come up with language that it would take, and my goal wasn't to get it to zero, and I don't know that it will end up being at a zero fiscal note, because frankly, when we're investing money, we really do need information, and so there is, we'll be able to get a lot closer to the zero number, but collectively, and I've got some language, but that we weren't able to prepare or that amendment, and not really sure exactly how much we want to include and not include. But the point is, the fiscal note won't be as large, and we're moving forward and getting a really plan that can be implemented, and it will help us as state legislators getting this information in one pile. I don't know, like University of Minnesota, maybe, I don't know if you're on higher ed, and Minnesota State, they have some performance measures. They report on them annually. So this isn't something new that the legislature expects from agencies, and it just helps us as legislators to make better policy and make a case for needed funding. So thank you.
Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess looking at the bill or the amendment as it is, and it's also in the bill, but on line 2.8 and 2.9, and you touched on it, about the plan, they got to come forward with the plan. It must be signed by a professional engineer. We're not talking about somebody outside consultant having to do this. Does MnDOT have the professional engineer's license in Minnesota on staff to do this, or we're not setting this up to have a bunch of consultants have to be hired and spend money that way?
Well,
Representative Bernardi.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good question, Representative Nelson. No consultants in this bill. MnDOT has, I mean, they would have to choose who it is. I talked with MnDOT yesterday. I mean, their deputy commissioner is a licensed engineer. So it would be by somebody who has an engineering license. And I don't know if it would be that person, but they would choose who it is.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I compliment you on your continued stress on the remaining service life of the roads. It's just good, solid, conservative thinking. Mm-hmm. Makes good sense, and I hope that proceeds, and it's important. My questions are related to 1.19 and 1.23. I'll start with line 1.23. I wonder how much flexibility there is available with that on an annual investment plan. District 7, really, I just saw their work the other day, and they pretty much, the local governments in District 7 know what MnDOT plans to do over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it would be called an annual investment plan, mm-hmm. but it's certainly those governments, and it works really well. Is that done, are you aware, is that done in other districts too, or is that only done in District 7?
Well, MnDOT might want to answer those questions, but I understand that they do get a funding level that each of the districts get, and they develop a STIP plan for that district over a 10-year period, and then their CHIP plan, which is a 4-year program. So each district does have that, and MnDOT can correct me if my answer is not correct.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, and then I think that is correct anyway, so I hope we don't make it too detailed. But that information is really valuable. I just was in the planning meeting, and the local government units, they're right on board with it. I'm curious about the gap identification. And when I think of gaps, I think about the gap in four-lane road between Nicollet and New Ulm and other gaps. I can imagine the gaps coming out of Wilmer and the gap over in Steele County. There's gaps in our road system. Is that what you're talking about there, or is there other kinds of gaps?
Well, thank you for asking that so I can clarify that for you. This is a performance mm-hmm. measurement plan, and what this gap is referring to is what did you set out for your goal for that year, and where did you end up? And then providing with us as a legislature the analysis of what happened, you know, why that goal wasn't met or why it was exceeded, so that we get some analysis in our data. And just want to comment on the first question you asked. You were sharing how that's valuable information. I don't know if every legislator has that for their district, but with this putting it in this format and taking a lot of things MnDOT already does and are working on and improving, it gets it, it brings it so that it's digestible to us. Because a lot of times, MnDOT does a ton of great work, and we get a lot of stuff, but bringing it to a level where we actually can use as policymakers and it's helpful to us, that's the intent.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask the author here, you've mentioned in a couple places you want to have these performance measures identified in collaboration with the public. And so help me understand, first of all, what the public might be able to help identify. So what's a performance measure the public might understand and identify?
Well, now I wish I had the SHIP, the Go Minnesota plan, or the, is it SHIP plan? I wish I had that with me, because actually MnDOT has done a lot of the, has started that work at the higher level, and the public has identified things that they care about and want measured, and they would be able to list through it. But I think the number one thing that they actually wanted measured, and it's part of the goals that MnDOT has in state statute, is to address, and it's a specific goal, and I don't have that memorized in the state statute. I think it's reducing carbon footprint. I don't know exactly what it is. But the public really wants the environment, and transportation contributes to, I don't know, about a, my lifeline. But, you know, I think I see different numbers, but like a third of the pollution in our state is caused by the transportation system, somewhere around that number. So that would be like one example. But I, you know, and I don't know what they, if they know a lot about remaining service life and that rises to the top, but they would be able to share what the public has been interested in. And then this makes it accountable. And a lot of times those things, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, MnDOT, but those sit in plans. This is to like bring it to the actual work of MnDOT, so the public can see how those things are, how they're performing against those things. So it's collaboration, so it's not in an, MnDOT's not an island unto themselves making internal and insular decisions, that the that we do have public engagement involved in it.
Representative Rundbeck,
okay,
follow
well,
up?
Mr. Chair, I just kind of concerned that this may result in, you know, a series of expensive sort of engagements and maybe not necessarily be productive. So I'm worried about that. And then you're saying all transportation modes. So this covers everything then. Bike, pedestrian, light rail, the whole nine yards.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck. She's Madam Chair on the other committee that I'm on. This is, it would not include light rail because MnDOT's not in charge of light rail, but they do have transit assets in their system and they're responsible for transit in greater Minnesota. So it includes the modes that MnDOT is responsible as it relates to the trunk highway. So it doesn't include like air, for example. So the trunk, does that answer your question, Representative Runbeck?
Not so. I think we should be specific.
Representative Runbeck, do you have another question?
Mr. Chair, I probably have several, but I think I'll pass.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bernardi, for bringing the bill. I like what you're actually telling in the bill, not asking, but what you're telling the department that you want them to do, and I think these are things they should be doing. Because of that, I like the bill. I don't like what MnDOT came back and said, you know, if we're going to do this, we're going to need another 21 FTEs and another $8 or $10 million of biennium. And I was reading the narrative in the fiscal note. Have you considered actually just including in the language, MnDOT's got over 4,000 employees, maybe suggesting and writing it in the bill that they take this one out of their hide and do the things we would want them to do otherwise and reprioritize their existing resources?
Representative Bernardi.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I don't get to control what MnDOT does on their fiscal note. I would have thought that this would be something that MnDOT would like already do in their organization, and working with them, I think we've been able to, with this bill, I think they do a lot of it, but that is something that I can't control that but it seems like this would be something with an agency who spends a lot of money that a bill like this that communicates well to the legislators and policymakers and the public would be something that MnDOT would do without charging all that money. But that's just my opinion.
A follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Bernardi, we can put it right in the bill. MnDOT, you will pay for this out of your existing resources and your existing complement of 4,000-plus employees. You put it right in the bill.
Well,
Representative
Mr. Chair,
Bernardi?
That is an amendment that somebody could do and it gets included in the omnibus bill. That's, you know, that could be a possibility.
Thank you. Does the department care to comment on this bill? I had heard a rumor that you would. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your comments.
Sure. My name is Mark Gieske. I'm the director of the Transportation System Management Office at MnDOT. And you were doing really well. So all the answers sounded great. I just wanted to make a comment on the final conversation about the fiscal impact of the bill. The original bill, not the one that's in the amendment, but the original one included a lot of project-level analysis, health impact assessments, economic analysis, things that are rather expensive to do on a project-level basis, things that we don't do now. The projects, most of the projects we do just don't warrant that kind of analysis. The original bill would have had us do that on every project, so the change to the amendment allows us to, a lot of those things aren't in there, so the impact was reduced.
Thank you, Mr. Kieske. Representative Bernardi, have you requested a revised fiscal note on this bill?
No, I have not, and I know you recommended that yesterday afternoon for me, so I will make sure that happens. And am I able to ask staff here to request that fiscal note for me?
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, I can put in a request for a revised fiscal note with the amended language.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Would you care to make any final comments, Representative Bernardi?
Well, just thank you, members. This has been a rewarding bill to work on with both sides of the aisle. Like I said, in the policy committee, there's not a lot of bills that we actually can come together on, but this has seemed to be one that has resonated with both sides, and I appreciate people's support on this and helping move this forward so we can have a great transportation system that spends our resources wisely.
Thank you, Representative. Would you like to renew your motion?
I'd like to renew my motion to pass House file, well, no, to lay over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Bill, House File 1155, as amended.
All those in favor, signify. Oh, wait a minute. It's laid over. I almost put it. It's almost worked. Representative Petersburg, House File 1241.
Okay.
Representative Petersburg, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1241 and lay it over for possible inclusion in the great transportation bill of this year.
Thank you, Representative. Go ahead with your presentation.
So if you thought the other two bills were a little bit too excessive and too expensive, you'll probably like this one. So we'll get on right onto the bill. As a lot of you know, in my life outside of the Capitol, I'm a church administrator of a large church down in Owatonna. We have about 4,000 members and a little over $2 million budget. And one of the things that I've learned through that is how we try to keep the congregation and others involved with the ministry of the church and what's going on. And it becomes a challenge because as something that large, groups and individuals work on a project and not everybody knows what's going on. And I think that's true even in transportation department, which is a very large agency, large group. Oftentimes we can get caught up into the day-to-day operations and we get caught up into the decisions that we have, and we forget that one of the main items of public policy is to help people stay informed of what's going on. And so this bill really is designed for transparency. And for me, another word for transparency is no surprises. And I think one of the things that we heard from the OLA report and others isn't necessarily that the department is intending to pick poor plans or whatever, but the fact that a lot of people didn't know the process and they didn't know what was going on, what the parameters of the decisions were, which again leads to a lot of misperception and a lot of misunderstanding. And so my bill is very specific, very simple in the request that it asks the department to determine best practices. And best practices is a word that's coming around a lot lately. But it really asks that the department stay in touch and involved with all the parties involved. And that includes from the Metropolitan Council to the federal programs to local road authorities, and to try to determine, you know, what is some of the processes that we need to go through when we pick plans. It's very evident to me that depending on the program that they're trying to set the plans for example, corridors of commerce versus the standard transportation investment plan, that they have different goals, that they have different parameters in which they need to set. So it's very difficult to put together a one-size-fits-all in that regard. But I do think we can come together with the best practices that I know the department has already done a lot of work with, and they've got some of that already in place. But this really is designed to help with the transparency, the no surprises from everybody involved. You know, when you go to have an evaluation done, or even in your own job, you'd like to know what the parameters are in which you're being judged by, so that you can know what to expect. And I think this is one of the plans and options for us to be able to do that. And so it's nothing extravagant, it's nothing big, but it just allows for us to do this. A couple of things that I think are important about the bill is it also then, as the OLA report says, it also talks about projects that weren't selected and for the reasons for that. And it also puts together that the report on the processes, the best practices, would come to the legislature because that is part of our responsibility as oversight. We will have an opportunity once that's done to see whether or not that's the direction we want. It's, in my opinion, always good when we ask somebody to do something that we've given them some sort of parameters so that they can actually accomplish it the way that we would like. And I believe this bill does that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Rep. Sam Petersburg. I do not see any questions. We will lay your bill over. Possibly, why don't you renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to for House File 1241 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Done. One more bill, folks.
No.
The questions. Enough the questions.
Mr. Marbles is chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1467 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and please go ahead with your testimony. Our presentation, sorry.
This is a very simple bill that directs MnDOT to report on the expanding use of tolling.
Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair. On this bill, it's a report on tolling to look into increased tolling. Is it talking toll booths, toll roads? Would this go at currently? I believe that we have local be able to, you know, local road project or locals that be able to say no, I don't want a toll road in my city. Would this disrupt that, or are we looking at trying to put toll roads across the state with this bill, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We actually do some tolling in Minnesota already. If you're familiar with the MinPass lanes in the metro area, they are technically toll roads, and we're just taking a look at their use and the potential use of other tolling in the state.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know the chairman was finished. I guess the question I have, the concern I have is, back when 610 was still left mostly undone, that after much money that was spent by the locals to make sure that land was set aside for the project and over the years, and it was just getting to the point where it was actually a project that was going to be put into the ground and start being driven on, there were some people that wanted to make that a toll road as opposed to all the other roads that we have. And like I said, there's some local concern that we were going to stick certain people with that toll roads. And I personally do not, other than the hot lanes, and I understand the philosophy behind that, I do not support toll roads. And that's why I'm asking that question.
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Representative. This is not an effort to impose toll roads in any part of Minnesota.
Any other questions? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking around the room trying to figure out if I was the only one who goes back as far as when Representative Workman was on this particular committee, and we had our first and big discussion about toll roads, which was buried so deep it was never heard from again until tonight. So it's an adventure. But I will tell you, Mr. Chair, that I did have a toll road bill, and it was for the Stillwater Bridge. I said, and the bill said, if the Stillwater Bridge were ever built, it had to be a toll bridge. And nobody in Minnesota cared at all that I had introduced that bill, but I was editorialized against in Wisconsin. So we know who are going to be the users of the Stillwater Bridge.
Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you. I'm surprised that the citizens of Wisconsin are trying to tell you what to do. They have no right.
Representative Hausman, do you have any follow-up? Any other questions on this bill? Is there anybody out in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? If not, I think, Chair Torkelson, we're ready for you to renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion that House File 1467 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails, and you are moving on. With that, I think this is the end of the meeting. Just a reminder, we have 8 or 9 bills coming up this Thursday at a regular time. And with that, Mr. Chair, I am adjourning the meeting.